You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
But I think the U.S. is very much bent on preventing any state from competing with the U.S. anywhere in the globe, even on the periphery of these other states. You know, that Russia's not even allowed to compete with the U.S. on its own borders. China's not allowed to compete with the U.S. in the South China Sea, even though it's called the South China Sea. Iran is not allowed to compete with the U.S. in the Persian Gulf. You know, Persia's not allowed to control the Persian Gulf. This explains a lot of what's happening. The U.S. really is at war with pretty much the whole world at this point.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dan Kovalik. Today's show, Russiagate, scapegoating Russia to justify endless war. Dan Kovalik is a labor and human rights lawyer. He teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. Dan Kovalik is the featured speaker Thursday, September 7th at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley, starting at 7:30 p.m. This event is part of the KPFA Speaker Series. Today we discuss the Cold War, the allegations against Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Russian Federation, the Yeltsin years in Russia, Nicaragua and Colombia, Afghanistan, Yemen, U.S. imperialism, and endless war. Dan Kovalik, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In your book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia, you point out, of course, that the vilification of Russia is really nothing new and dates back a couple of centuries. What does seem to be new, though, is the vilification of the Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Historically, do you know of any other Russian leader who has been demonized the way Putin has come under attack in the West?
Certainly not a sitting leader. You know, no one that I know of has been attacked while they were the head of the Russian state. As Stephen F. Cohen has pointed out, in fact, there's been a lot of examples of U.S. presidents having warm relationships with the heads of Russia, or during the first Cold War, the heads of the Soviet Union. So, you know, Kennedy ended up having a warm relationship with Khrushchev. Nixon had a good relationship with Brezhnev. Reagan obviously became very close to Gorbachev, and they ended the Cold War together. And initially, you might recall that George W. Bush considered Putin a friend. In fact, he said, "I looked into Putin's eyes and I saw his soul." And so that is the typical type of relationship with standing leaders of Russia. And yeah, now, of course, as you mentioned, it's something new where Putin has been vilified to the point that I've never seen any other leader vilified, truthfully.
What have the charges against Russia and Putin consisted of, and who and what organizations have been making these accusations?
Well, again, this has been going on for some time. Things even began to chill during George W. Bush's tenure, in part because while Putin was the first leader, I'll just remind folks, world leader to call George W. Bush and express his condolences after 9/11 and offer help in Afghanistan with Bush's operations, and he did give that help. Things did begin to sour in 2003 when Putin did not go along with the invasion of Iraq, which he saw as wrong-headed and something that would only increase terrorism. And, of course, history has shown that Putin was absolutely correct in that. Under Obama, there was a thaw under Medvedev, who was president during some of Obama's tenure. In fact, Obama said he wanted to reboot or reset relations with Russia under Medvedev. But things got sour with Medvedev and Putin for a number of reasons, but in large part because of the Libya invasion that Obama was one of the leaders of. You might recall that the U.S. went to the Security Council to set up a no-fly zone over Libya under the pretense of protecting human rights. By the way, all of the justifications it gave for that no-fly zone quickly fell apart. But nonetheless, Russia and China agreed to abstain on the vote for the no-fly zone resolution under the condition that the no-fly zone would not morph into regime change. Of course, it did quickly morph into regime change with Gaddafi being overthrown. He was famously murdered after being sodomized, all on video, which one could watch on YouTube if they have the stomach. And apparently Putin did watch the video and was repulsed by it. And this is when I think Putin himself begins to really distrust the United States, and things begin to go sour. So this has been a long line of incidents and people who have led us down the path to where we are now.
Donald Trump has been accused of somehow colluding with Vladimir Putin and Russia since well before the presidential election. Trump is now in the eighth month of his presidency. What concrete evidence of this Russian collusion has been confirmed?
Well, very little of it. First of all, John Pilger, a journalist I really respect, said he said there's not even really allegations, you know, much less proven ones. But what are the allegations? One, the kind of the font of it all is the allegation that Putin was behind the alleged hacking of the DNC emails, Podesta's emails that end up being released by WikiLeaks. There's little to no evidence, truthfully, that Russia did it. In fact, there's a recent study that was put out by the veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity, who did a study saying that they, in fact, believe that the DNC computer was not hacked at all, but that it was leaked, that someone on the inside copied the emails, put them on a disk or flash drive, and that they were stolen that way, not through a remote hack. And so that's part of the story. Again, the font of all this just seemed to fall apart. So then all we're left with are alleged meetings. And most recently, and this came out this week, there's some emails that were released where some real estate mogul who's from Russia claimed he could help Trump get elected, and that part of this process through Putin, and that part of this process would involve Trump's building a new property in Russia, I believe a new hotel. And a lot of people have made hay of this, saying, hey, this guy said, hey, I can get you in the White House with the help of Putin. And this proves, you know, collusion. But actually, there's a story today which kind of points out the obvious. If you look at the Washington Post story on this, what's clear is nothing happened with this claim by this intermediary. That is to say, the building, Trump's building, was never built in Russia. The intermediary who says I can help you get elected through Putin admits in the same emails, and this is in, you know, the mainstream press now, that once Trump's campaign began in earnest sometime in November to December of 2015, all of his efforts around the hotel and Putin ended. That is to say, the story collapses on itself. And one sees the headline, which is, hey, you know, there's this Russian expat that bragged he could help Trump get elected through Putin, but it just turned out this was a hollow brag. And again, most of these incidents fall apart when you really look at them. You know, the bottom line is always nothing happened. And so I think we will see very little to no evidence about this type of collusion. But that hasn't stopped the press, of course, from obsessing about it 24/7.
And what organizations and people, in addition to the mainstream media, are lobbying these charges against Russia colluding with the Trump election? And what about the hacks of the DNC emails? You've mentioned that. Now, who else besides the mainstream media keep lobbying these charges?
Well, of course, you have the Democratic Party, and particularly the folks aligned with Hillary Clinton in the Democratic Party, who obviously are trying to make political hay out of this. And we know from the book Shattered that came out this year that John Podesta himself, right after the election, came up with the idea to blame Hillary's loss on Russia. For obvious reasons. If she had any chance of running again, it was seen as convenient to blame, you know, another country instead of blaming Hillary herself for running a poor campaign, which I think she did. I mean, the other interesting fact is Comey's now become this hero because he started going after Trump for the Russia collusion. So you have Comey, you have other folks in the FBI, you have folks in the CIA who made it clear that they do not want to rapprochement with Russia. They made it clear that Trump was wrong in seeking such a detente with Russia. And it seems that all these groups together in the press have succeeded in preventing a detente with Russia. So when Trump meets with Putin at the G20 recently, for example, one, it's like a big deal. It's somehow treasonous that he even met him, especially because they found out he had a secret one-hour meeting that folks didn't know about to begin with, again, which is fairly typical for heads of state. But in any case, instead of being congratulated for meeting with Putin and coming to some agreements on cooperation in Syria and the Ukraine, Trump is largely criticized for meeting with Putin. And then right after this, Congress overwhelmingly approves a new round of sanctions against Russia right after the president agrees with Putin to act cooperatively. Again, clearly intended to derail any chance of Trump and Putin working together on anything. So it seems to me there's a lot of folks in the government, including in the Congress, both Republican and Democrat, and in the press, who do not want to see any good relationship with Russia.
Now, why do you think that is? Obviously, the Democratic Party doesn't want a rapprochement with Russia. The intelligence agencies don't seem to want it, or a large part of the intelligence agencies. The media has gotten on the bandwagon, of course. Then there's a question about the military-industrial complex. Where do they stand on this? Why is it that all of these powerful forces, in your opinion, do not want to have good relations with the Russian Federation?
Well, I think, of course, if we start with the military-industrial complex, there's obvious reasons there. You know, obviously, they benefit from war, and that's becoming a huge part of the U.S. economy is war. In fact, Congress ended up giving Trump more money in the military budget than he even asked for. And he was already asking for an increase, which was equivalent to 80% of Russia's entire military budget. Meanwhile, Putin has announced a 25% decrease in his military, I'll note.
I'm speaking with human rights attorney and author Dan Kovalik. Today's show, Russiagate, scapegoating Russia to justify endless war. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
There are obviously vested interests in having war all the time. In fact, they used to say, you know, the business of the U.S. is business. I think the business of the U.S. is now war. And, you know, you see us fighting on multiple fronts in wars that seem to go on without end. Afghanistan, of course, is an example. And they seem to go on without end by design. And again, a rapprochement with Russia would risk possibly peace breaking out, which folks don't want. So I think that's one thing that's happening. I think the other thing that's happening is that a lot of folks in power and in the ruling class see that the economic system is in grave crisis. We had, of course, the huge recession of 2008, which was, you know, nearly catastrophic. We really haven't recovered since then, though. You know, there's claims that we have, but it's clear we haven't. Certainly the people haven't recovered. And I think that there is a desire to maybe, you know, reconfigure the globe so that the economic system will be saved, one, through war, but also through more penetration of countries and their resources, and also by preventing countries like Russia and China, for example, from taking their own share of the world's resources. I mean, in essence, I think the U.S. wants to engage in more extreme imperialist activity, for lack of a better term. I know that's not a term people like, imperialism. We're an empire that we don't admit it to ourselves. But I think the U.S. is very much bent on preventing any state from competing with the U.S. anywhere in the globe, even on the periphery of these other states. You know, that Russia's not even allowed to compete with the U.S. on its own borders. China's not allowed to compete with the U.S. in the South China Sea, even though it's called the South China Sea. Iran is not allowed to compete with the U.S. in the Persian Gulf. You know, Persia's not allowed to control the Persian Gulf. You know, and so I think this explains a lot of what's happening, that the U.S. really, I think if one were objective about it, is at war with pretty much the whole world at this point. And you see, you know, sanctions regime after sanction regime being leveled against all sorts of countries now, military threats against all sorts of countries. It's a very dangerous situation, but it seems to be dangerous by design, really.
You write that the vilification of Russia and the Russian president constitutes a new Cold War. What about the old Cold War? You write extensively about the original Cold War against the USSR. When did the Cold War against the USSR begin, and who initiated it?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, I mean, I think the Cold War with a capital C and a capital W started right after World War II. I believe, as other writers like William Bloom, who I really respect, believe that the opening shots of the first Cold War was the U.S.'s atomic atom bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that those were not aimed at Japan, who was in fact trying to surrender to the U.S. despite what we've been told in history books, but it was a signal more to the Soviet Union that we have these weapons, and it was a signal for the Soviet Union to keep in line. And I think that was the opening shot of the Cold War. Again, just as World War II is ending, and we were allies, obviously, with the Soviet Union during World War II. And so we wasted no time in beginning hostilities with them. And again, of course, very quickly, we begin hostilities in the Korean Peninsula as well in 1948, though, again, we're told 1950. But really, in 1948, we start to help Japan and pro-Japanese forces in Korea try to reestablish Japanese colonial rule in Korea, and this leads to the conflict there. And so I think we can trace the Cold War as we think about it back to that point, but we can even go farther back than that. I mean, I think folks have to remember that the U.S. and a number of other capitalist countries invaded the Soviet Union right after the revolution. The revolution being, of course, in October of 1917. By the old calendar, by the new calendar, was November 7th, 1917. A number of capitalist countries, including the United States, invaded Russia in 1918 to try to strangle the revolution in its crib. And so one could trace the Cold War even as far back as 1918. So this has been going on for quite some time. But again, the whole raison d'etre, or what we were told was the raison d'etre of the Cold War, was to fight communism. And so the Russians thought that if they would give up socialism, that the U.S. and the West would welcome them back into the West with open arms. And that never happened. The U.S. seemed to never want peace with Russia, whether they were socialist or communist or capitalist. And the Russians learned that the hard way after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. They were never admitted back into the community of nations. And I think that the U.S. bears great responsibility for that, if not sole responsibility for that fact. And I think we need to go back and look at that history and the U.S.'s own role in continuing hostilities with Russia when that original causes belli of communism went away.
That's Dan Kovalik I was speaking with. The show, Russiagate, Scapegoating Russia to Justify Endless War. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We are fundraising for KPFA today, and I am absolutely delighted to be able to offer for a $90 tax-deductible donation to KPFA Dan Kovalik's brand-new book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. This is a book that deserves your support. It's the only book that's been written so far about the propaganda against Russia. Please give us a call, $90, and we would be delighted to send you this book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Please call us at 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732, or securely online, of course, at kpfa.org. $90, that's tax deductible. That donation goes to keep KPFA on the air. The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. It's really pretty incredible when you think about the fact that the President of the United States is being criticized for wanting to even speak to the head of the Russian Federation, which is a nuclear power. It's unbelievable. And Dan Kovalik breaks down a lot of information in this book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. He goes over the allegations, everything about this, what I would call Russiagate. And he goes into great detail about how the U.S. has been meddling in Russia, not vice versa, how the U.S. Breaks its promises. It's always double-crossing agreements. That's happened in Syria. He talks about how when Reagan and Gorbachev, I guess you heard that, came to an agreement about taking down the wall in Germany, that NATO would not move against Russia. Well, double-cross them right there. 1-800-439-5732. The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Please support this book. Support Dan Kovalik. This is very, very important because we have a mass media that is absolutely against Russia, and it's all fabricated. The Democratic Party talks about the Democratic Party, talks about the intelligence agencies. You know, it was interesting because KPFA hosted a CIA whistleblower named Mel Goodman, and I went to that event, and Mel Goodman was bemoaning the fact that the CIA has politicized its intelligence. But what he was really upset about is that because they had politicized their intelligence, that no one will believe them anymore when they claim that Russia was meddling in our elections. So this Mel Goodman guy was actually supporting Russiagate and the Russian propaganda. I was astounded. I'm glad I went to that event and I heard that. 1-800-439-5732, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. This is an important book. The author needs your support. This is something that is very, very dangerous, this vilification of Russia. As Dan Kovalik points out, this has been going on for centuries, and it is insane, and it could lead to war. You know, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has written an incredible article about how the United States has circled Russia with missiles. And according to Paul Craig Roberts, the U.S., he thinks in his analysis that the U.S. is planning a first strike nuclear attack on Russia, and that these U.S. missiles that surround Russia are in order to prevent them from retaliating. I was actually aghast when I read that, but there's a lot to that. 1-800-439-5732, a $90 tax-deductible contribution, and we would be delighted to send you this book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. And I would like to take a minute or two of your time to thank everyone who came out to the 9/11 Film Festival this Monday, September 11th. It was a very nicely attended crowd. It was a big success. It was wonderful to see Bill Pepper in person. He gave a wonderful speech, of course, about the assassination of Martin Luther King. KPFA producer George Coates showed up. Of course, he produces TwitWit Radio, and that's Sunday evenings at 6:30 p.m. That's a great show, a very funny show, very trenchant. You should tune in for that one. Also, who else came? The head of the San Francisco Tesla Society showed up, George Gabori and his wife. They showed up. And, of course, my two favorite scientists showed up, Beverly and Harry. I got to greet a lot of KPFA supporters who man the KPFA phone room during fund drives, and they're probably in there right now waiting to take your call at 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org, and $90. A $90 well spent. It supports KPFA, keeps the station on the air, and it supports Dan Kovalik with this very, very, what I consider to be very important book. It's the only one. 1-800-439-5732. And I guess you heard him say that it was John Podesta himself who came up with the idea to blame Hillary's loss on Russia. I hear, you know, it's strange. I've heard from some listeners that even shows on KPFA are broadcasting the Russians are coming. This is very dangerous stuff. And I think that President Trump is very correct. He should be talking to President Putin. That's a nuclear power. These are very, very, this Russian propaganda is very, very dangerous. And Dan Kovalik goes into that. 1-800-439-5732, securely online at kpfa.org. And I want to thank everybody again for your wonderful attendance at the 9/11 Film Festival. I saw old friends and Nuance. It was a really successful event, and I thank you so much. And I also hope that you will call and support KPFA. KPFA is the first station that sponsored Guns and Butter. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call, a $90 donation, and we will send you The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, what do you think, Michael? Let's get back and hear a little bit more of this interview I did with Dan Kovalik.
Quote from your book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, quote, while the dreaded Putin has been president on and off since 1999, he did not stray beyond the old Soviet borders, and really not all that far until nearly the end of 2015. And there, of course, you're referring to Syria. During that same time, the U.S. has itself militarily intervened in Syria, both covertly and overtly, through major bombing raids, engaged in a major bombing campaign of Serbia, very close to Russia, overthrew the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, invaded Afghanistan, which it has yet to leave, invaded Iraq, which it has yet to leave, engaged in what it termed anti-terrorist operations in Georgia on the border of Russia, Djibouti, Kenya, Ethiopia, Yemen, and Eritrea, engaged in military actions in Somalia, which ended up destabilizing that country for years to come, supported the coup against the democratic government of Zelaya in Honduras, and participated in the NATO invasion and dismantling of Libya, end quote. And here you're only referring to U.S. actions since 1999. How does this fit with the accusations of Russian expansionism?
I think Russian claims of Russian expansionism pale in comparison. I mean, I'm just always amazed when people say, hey, well, what about Putin in Ukraine? What about Putin in Syria? And pretty much the list ends there, right there, right? And look at all the countries that we've invaded. And by the way, these were all wars of choice. They weren't necessary. And the Physicians for Social Responsibility just released a study saying that in the U.S. wars in the Middle East since September 11th, 2001, the U.S. has killed up to about 2 million people in the Middle East. If we go back to since 1990, 4 million people. 4 million people. And again, the idea that people are exercised about what Putin might be doing in the east part of Ukraine or in Syria, and yet seem utterly unconcerned about what the U.S. is doing throughout the globe, including, by the way, in Yemen right now. You know, Yemen has the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. Millions of people will die there. Millions. This is according to the United Nations. Through starvation, through disease, because of a war that Saudi Arabia most prominently is fighting against Yemen, but with very critical support from the United States, including weaponry, logistical support, the mid-air refueling of its planes, which then go and bomb civilians in Yemen. Millions of people will die because of that war, which I would say if you asked 1 in 10,000 people, you'd be lucky to have one who even knew it was happening. And if they did, they wouldn't be able to explain what was happening there. Yet the press seems very unconcerned about that. Again, meanwhile, focusing on the couple conflicts that Putin may be involved in. And I just think it's that sort of disproportionate and frankly unfair media portrayals of what, you know, the U.S. and Russia are doing in the world relative to each other that I just find absolutely galling and confounding that they're able to get away with it, that people seem to buy it. They seem to have been convinced that, well, there's a Russian under every bed, and meanwhile seem unconcerned about what the U.S. is doing around the globe.
It's also significant that when a story, let's say Russiagate, is repeatedly broadcast, that it crowds out other important news. And now you have just mentioned the war in Yemen. You point out that the war in Yemen is actually in its third year, and that this war began under Obama. What kind of support is the U.S. supplying to the Saudis for the attack on Yemen? And did the Clinton Foundation have any connection with the war in Yemen?
Well, yes. As I note in the book, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, approved a major sale of fighter jets to Saudi Arabia just after the Clinton Foundation received a huge a donation from Saudi Arabia, millions of dollars. Was that a quid pro quo? I don't know. But certainly there was the appearance of impropriety there that she was approving this weapon sale after her foundation received a huge donation from Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, the U.S. has provided, in addition to such fighter jets, billions of dollars of military hardware, cluster bombs, which are being used in Yemen, again, helping Saudi Arabia find targets to bomb in Yemen. They're refueling the bombing planes midair, and also have helped with the Saudi blockade against Yemen, which, again, is starving out the people there. Again, according to the UN, 7 million people at least are on the verge of starvation. Meanwhile, almost 500,000 people are now suffering from cholera, again, all because of this war and this blockade, which the U.S. is intimately involved with. And again, this began under Obama, Saint Obama, that everyone now looks back to so wistfully. And I understand why. I mean, obviously, Trump is a pretty reprehensible guy. But Obama did very reprehensible things, including in Yemen, including in Libya, which, by the way, in Libya, post-invasion, which, again, was led by Obama and spurred on by Hillary Clinton, there are now slaves being publicly sold on the streets of Libya. This is a fact. You can look it up. This makes the mainstream press once in a while. This was directly the result of that invasion that Obama was a key part of. And, again, there's this weird thing in the U.S., which basically, if I'm a Democrat and a Democratic president does these horrible things, I don't care. I mean, that just seems to be a common reaction. But actually, the opposite isn't necessarily true. That is to say, very curiously, while people find much to criticize about Trump, and there is much to criticize, but the one time he got a bump in his ratings, approval ratings, is after he launched 59 Tomahawk missiles against Syria earlier this year in response to an alleged chemical attack in Syria. It appears that on matters of war and peace, sadly, the American public is largely indifferent to it. Even though the things folks want, you know, better health care, bigger social safety net, jobs, etc., better infrastructure, those things are being sacrificed by the U.S., which has decided instead to spend trillions of dollars on wars, which have no benefit to the average American person. Under Obama, by the way, Obama began a $1 trillion modernization of the U.S.'s nuclear weapon stockpile, and that's continued under Trump. That modernization, which according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, appears designed and intended to give the U.S. first strike capability, nuclear capability against Russia. I don't see anyone pushing the panic button about that. But it seems like if you were going to panic about anything, it would be about the possibility of a nuclear war.
You include in your book the plot to scapegoat Russia, a quote from Russian President Vladimir Putin, quote, "Anyone who doesn't regret the passing of the Soviet Union has no heart. Anyone who wants it restored has no brains," end quote. The vast majority of Soviet citizens wanted to preserve the Soviet Union. Why do you think this is? And how has the collapse of the Soviet Union affected the working class worldwide?
Well, I mean, they wanted the continuation. And a referendum that was held in 1991 across the Soviet Union showed about 78% for the support of the of the Soviet Union and the continuation of the Soviet Union. They supported it because, frankly, the Soviet Union, for all of its faults, brought a good standard of living to the people of the Soviet Union, including Russia. It managed to defeat Nazi Germany, and it brought great pride to the people, again, particularly of Russia, which obviously was the dominant country in the Soviet Union. And the collapse has not brought about the peace and prosperity that the Russians were promised or that any of the rest of us were. You know, once the Soviet Union collapsed and China, as a result, gave up really on its design for socialism, or at least put it off for some time, this ends up opening huge markets for the West. And what happened was that the U.S. started massively offshoring its labor, causing devastation to this country in terms of jobs and good jobs. And the other thing the Soviet Union did, it did create a certain amount of balance in the world, which frankly is greatly needed at this time.
Now, wasn't Russia and then later the USSR excellent allies of the United States in both world wars?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, in World War II, even to say they were good allies really understates what they were. I mean, folks have to remember the U.S. didn't enter the European theater in a serious way in World War II till 1944. You know, really, they kind of held back until the Russians had pretty much came close to defeating Hitler. You know, they really bore the brunt of the war in Europe. And I think the world owes Russia debt for that effort. And they lost 27 million people in the process. And now, by the way, there's a huge revisionism that's been happening for years where now the U.S. claims, oh, we won the war and Britain won the war. Well, again, I'm not saying that they didn't play a role. But now folks are trying to deny the substantial role that the Russia had in winning the war. And it's that sort of revisionism, which is crucial, by the way, to allowing us to continue to vilify Russia. Because if folks, you know, remember the truth that Russia was so critical in defeating Nazism, it's much harder to claim that Putin is the equivalent to Hitler, for example, which Hillary Clinton has claimed. People are even trying to claim that Putin's somehow behind, you know, the alt-right in the U.S. and the alt-right demonstrations in Charlottesville, when in fact Russia just recently sponsored a anti-fascist resolution in the U.N., which the U.S. voted against. But again, if you don't remember what happened during World War II and which country fought on which side, it's easier to be taken in by this sort of propaganda.
In your book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia, you quote George Kennan, State Department Director of Policy Planning in 1948, quote, "Were the Soviet Union to sink tomorrow under the waters of the ocean, the American military-industrial establishment would have to go on substantially unchanged until some other adversary could be invented." Why do you think this is so?
Well, again, because certainly since World War II, the U.S. economy has been based on the military-industrial complex, continuous warfare. And if you don't have enemies, you can't have wars. And so the U.S. has constantly been in search for enemies. Again, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it's a little difficult to claim it needed to fight Russia, so it came up, you know, with other justifications for war, fighting drugs, fighting terrorism, when in fact the U.S. was in some ways promoting drugs and terrorism. The U.S. needs its scapegoats and it needs its enemies to continue justifying spending more on its military than what the next nine countries or so combined. No one would put up with that if they thought there wasn't a reason for it. But people do put up with it, largely because I guess, buy that countries like Russia truly are a threat to the United States. And that's why I wrote the book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, to argue, in fact, that Russia is not an enemy and that this is being really foisted on us to justify conflicts that are not in our benefit.
Dan Kovalik, thank you so much. And I look forward to meeting you in person on Thursday, September 7th in Berkeley.
Thank you, Bonnie. And I appreciate the opportunity for this interview. I enjoyed it.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dan Kovalik. Today's show has been Russiagate, Scapegoating Russia to Justify Endless War. Dan Kovalik is a labor and human rights lawyer. He teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. Dan Kovalik is the featured speaker Thursday, September 7th at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley, starting at 7:30 p.m. This event is part of the KPFA Speakers Series. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
This is Bonnie Faulkner, and this is Guns and Butter. Somehow that there was a little confusion about what tracks to play, so I'm sorry about that. I didn't want the last end of the show to be played, and so we missed the whole section on Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin and the Duma catastrophe, which I really wanted you to hear. But be that as it may, 1-800-439-5732. We're offering today for a $90 donation, a tax-deductible donation to KPFA, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia, by Dan Kovalik, introduction by David Talbot. This is a book that you need to support. 1-800-439-5732. I'd like to read you what some people have had to say about this book. Now, if you'll remember, several years ago, I broadcast Philip F. Nelson. He is the author of LBJ, The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination, and LBJ, From Mastermind to the Colossus. And I still have people coming up and asking me about that book. What he had to say about The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, quote, Dan Kovalik's book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, is a beautifully written, uncommonly coherent, and very compelling treatise on the issues facing America today, a troubling indictment of where we've been and where we're headed. Moreover, this book is profoundly important and a timely retrospective review of American foreign policy misadventures since the advent of the Cold War. That's The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, a very important book, needs your support, a $90 tax-deductible contribution to KPFA today at 1-800-439-5732. Of course, you can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Now, here's what Joan Mellon has to say about this book. The Plot to Scapegoat Russia confronts the timeliest of subjects, the effort to resuscitate the Cold War by blaming Russian President Vladimir Putin for interfering in the 2016 presidential campaign on behalf of Donald Trump, an effort pursued by the CIA and the Democratic Party working in tandem. Kovalik establishes that not a scintilla of evidence has emerged to grant credibility to this self-serving fantasy, and he deftly eviscerates the mainstream press. Reading this book will be salutary, illuminating, and more than instructive. That from Joan Mellon. Of course, you know her. She was the author of an incredible book on the JFK assassination, A Farewell to Justice. And her new book, of course, is Faustian Bargains, Lyndon Johnson and Mack Wallace in the Robber Baron Culture of Texas. That's what she has to say about the plot to scapegoat Russia. There's a lot in this book. A lot of it I wasn't even able to fit into an hour-long interview with Dan Kovalik. He goes over Latin America and the American wars in Latin America in detail. He talks about the genocide in Guatemala of the indigenous Mayan Indians since 1956. He talks about Colombia, 1999, Plan Colombia, 1997 to 2007. And I guess you heard him talk about Colombia having the most internally displaced population in the world. He writes about the paramilitaries, the counter-narcotics rationale. Also included in the book, he discusses Chile and Pinochet, the takeover of Chile by Pinochet in 9/11/1973, of course, with American help. He also writes about Operation Condor, the assassinations in South America. That's all in The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. A $90 pledge, 1-800-439-5732, securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'm sorry we didn't get to hear. I wanted to play for you what Dan Kovalik said about Bill Clinton when he was president and his support for Boris Yeltsin, how the United States helped Boris Yeltsin come to power. And Boris Yeltsin, of course, oversaw the rise of the oligarchs, the ripoff of the Russian state property, the privatization of it, and the institution of austerity in Russia. How, you know, a lot of the pensioners were thrown out on the streets to beg. Bill Clinton personally used to talk to Yeltsin, sometimes almost daily. Dan Kovalik goes into this. He talks about the Duma catastrophe. A lot of people don't remember. Boris Yeltsin, there was a sit-in in the Duma, which is the Russian parliament, a sit-in against Boris Yeltsin's austerity programs by a lot of people in the Communist Party. Boris Yeltsin turned off the electricity and the water to the Russian Duma, and when that didn't get rid of the protesters, he bombed his own parliament. And as Dan Kovalik pointed out in my interview, hundreds, if not thousands, of people died. We don't even know. We don't even know. And one thing that I didn't mention to Dan Kovalik, which I thought I'd remember to mention, I remember reading that when Boris Yeltsin died, Bill Clinton cried. So with the Russian propaganda entails Russia colluding in our elections in the United States, when in fact it's the exact opposite. It's the United States interfering in Russian elections. According to Medvedev, the communists actually won the election, but that Boris Yeltsin stole it with the help of the United States. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. A $90 donation to KPFA today, and we can send you this important book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. This is the only book written so far to counter the anti-Russia propaganda. 1-800-439-5732. We need your support on KPFA to keep this radio station vibrant. You can pledge securely online, of course, at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Looks like we've got another 5 minutes to try and get some more of you on the phone or online to support KPFA and to support this great book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. This is very important. This is what Peter Janney, the author of Mary's Mosaic, the CIA conspiracy to murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and their vision for world peace. This is what he had to say about the plot to scapegoat Russia. The plot to scapegoat Russia underscores how the CIA's infiltration and shaping of the media, which began in the 1950s, successfully continues today. A very worthwhile account for anyone who wants to understand how reality is manufactured while real truth is murdered and buried. That's from Peter Janney, the author of Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace. 1-800-439-5732. A $25 donation to KPFA makes you a member for a year. It will also enable you to vote in the KPFA upcoming local station board elections. A $90 pledge, and we can send you this great book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. There's a lot in this book. There's whole sections on Hillary Clinton, her involvement in the Honduras coup d'etat against Zelaya, who was kidnapped, how their elections were interfered in. He goes into the National Endowment for Democracy, journalists that have been killed, how Putin has been ridiculed for complaining about the National Endowment for Democracy and the non-governmental organizations meddling in Russia. He writes about the destruction of Libya, also about Sidney Blumenthal, who was the closest advisor to Hillary Clinton, and, of course, about the takedown of Libya and Muammar Gaddafi, how the capital of the African Union, Sirte, was leveled under Obama and Hillary Clinton. 1-800-439-5732, $90, and we can send you The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. We need your support, and this is a book that you need to support, and you need to support Dan Kovalik. This has been the only book so far that has been written about the propaganda about Russia. And this is, and you know, I talked to Dan Kovalik at length as to why? What is going on? Why are we vilifying Putin? You know, I didn't get to play the part, but we go into the fact that the Russian GDP is not much more than the country of Portugal or Spain. Russia is not a threat to the United States. It makes no sense. The United States needs to create enemies in order to pump up the a military-industrial complex. But, you know, the United States, as he pointed out, really needs more balance in the world and other strong countries to balance us out, like the USSR and China may have done but no longer do. 1-800-439-5732, $90, and we will send you The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Please support this fund drive on KPFA. Please support Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner, and, of course, this is Guns and Butter. And I want to thank everybody who has called in to support us, and I hope you will continue to call 1-800-439-5732 or securely online at kpfa.org. Dick Russell has also written, at a time when the U.S. military budget is again soaring to enrich the oligarchs, this timely and thought-provoking book turns Orwellian doublethink on its head in a cogent analysis of what's really behind all the saber-rattling against Russia. In a scholarly but also deeply personal and fluidly written work, Dan Kovalik pulls no punches in dissecting the history of how America has justified its own imperialistic aims through the Cold War era and right up to the current anti-Putin hysteria, which really constitutes a new Cold War. 1-800-439-5732, $90 will send you the book. $25 makes you a member, but please make that call. 1-800-439-5732 or securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can email me at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. I'd like to thank everyone who's called in to support the show, to support this wonderful book. And thanks to Michael Yoshida. And I'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we plaintively ask, where are Esquire magazine's dubious achievement awards now that we really need them? We'll hear from Con Hallinan, singer David Rovix, and yours truly. I hope you'll stay tuned. I have been a magazine fan all my life. It probably really started when I was about 8. One day, I was searching for treasure in the town dump, and I found some. A whole roll of movie theater-type tickets, and a half dozen issues of a magazine that was new to me. No, it wasn't Playboy. That would have made a better story than this one. No, it was Boy's Life. That turned out to be a way cool magazine to my 8-year-old mind. There were always magazines in my house when I was a kid. The Reader's Digest, National Geographic, Time, the Saturday Evening Post, and then Look magazine when the Post went belly up. Red Book for Mom, and Together, the mid-month magazine for Methodist families. And, of course, TV Guide. I think my parents owned only about 8 books between them. That's including the sex manual they hid in the linen closet. Surely no child would bother to go snooping in the linen closet, right? So they had about 8 books total. But we always had plenty of magazines. Then, in 8th or 9th grade in school, in my civics class, they had a unit on magazines that carried political articles. That's when my love of magazines really started to take off. The class examined The Nation magazine, The Reporter, The National Review, Saturday Review, Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report, The Atlantic Monthly, and Harper's. Maybe also The New Yorker. Maybe The New Republic. Possibly I.F. Stone's Weekly? Anyway, we studied at least a dozen of them, spanning the American political spectrum. Okay, that's a pretty narrow spectrum, but they spanned it. Great stuff. I loved it. Half of those titles are gone now, either entirely dead or else decomposed into some grotesque, internet-based, multimedia something or other. I.F. Stone's Weekly, The Reporter, Saturday Review, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, and, just the other day, The New Republic. All gone. Later, I discovered the more radical magazines, Ramparts, and The Realist, and Mother Earth News, and Avant-Garde. All also now dead and buried. Speaking of Avant-Garde, did you know that Avant-Garde magazine is one of the very few serial publications to have a typeface named after it? That puts Avant-Garde right up there with the Times of London. That's where the Times Roman typeface comes from. The Times of London commissioned it. Well, the Times is still with us, but Avant-Garde is most sincerely dead. Losing all those good magazines, one by one, was like watching my aunts and uncles die off. Not a personal calamity, but it does make me feel sad and wistful. Then there are the old magazines that changed for the worse. The ones you just want to shoot and put out of their misery. At the top of my list here is Esquire. I really liked Esquire, and I subscribed to it back in the 1970s. Back when they featured fine writing by the so-called New Journalists School. Long, interesting articles by the likes of Norman Mailer, Seymour Hersh, Terry Southern. Back when they had those witty and wonderfully provocative studio photographs by George Lois on the cover. Now Esquire is just a fashion magazine, appealing to fashion and grooming-conscious, trendy, upscale male yuppies who are still halfway in the closet and being coy. And completing its own degradation, in 2008, Esquire terminated its famous annual feature, the Dubious Achievement Awards. Each February issue, I think it was, the Dubious Achievement Awards would highlight some egregious follies and blunders by prominent public figures of the previous year. Each item would have a witty, ironic headline, followed by a short, factual news item, sometimes with an unflattering photo. Part of the fun was that the headline often didn't make sense until you had read the news item. Sometimes, not until you had read the next news item. Then you'd get the joke. On the internet last night, I found Esquire's final Dubious Achievement Awards. They were published February 2008. Here's a classic example. The headline reads, "And in an even bigger waste of resources, they brought her back." The news item reads, "NBC flew Ann Curry from New York to the South Pole for a report on global warming." Here's another item. The headline would take too long to explain. The item reads, "After dining at Sylvia's, a soul food restaurant in Harlem, Bill O'Reilly said on his syndicated radio show, 'I couldn't get over the fact that there was no difference between Sylvia's restaurant and any other restaurant, even though it's run by blacks, primarily black patronship.' He added, 'There wasn't one person in Sylvia's screaming, M-effer, I want some more iced tea.'" Isn't that a great item? Can you picture it? There's right-wing crackpot pundit Bill O'Reilly in a restaurant in Harlem, and the people are all just sitting there politely eating dinner, and not once does anyone shout out the word Mother Fletcher or something similar. O'Reilly is so rattled by the experience that words fail him, and he starts inventing new words, like the restaurant has a black patronship. Patronship? Maybe clientele just sounded too French to O'Reilly's patriotic ear. But I digress. One more item from Esquire's final Dubious Achievement Awards, covering the year 2007. The headline is, "So that was the tainted dog food?" And the item is, "In an effort to show that it was serious about improving the safety of its products, China executed its former top food and drug regulator." Anyway, in early 2008, completing its own self-imposed degradation, Esquire magazine announced that it had tired of and outgrown its annual Dubious Achievement Awards, and this set would be the last. Killing this feature freed up 4 pages for More photo spreads on the season's hottest $75 a bottle men's colognes, and the best new German electric shavers to give you that trendy one-day-old beard look each morning, plus more Hollywood celebrities and highlights of the new men's clothing displayed at the Milan Fashion Show this season. So, dubious achievement awards, hail and farewell. We salute you. Esquire magazine, take a hike. And take Details magazine with you. And Men's Health, too. They're gone, but the dubious achievement awards remain a fond memory that I cling to. A memory like good public schools and honest elections and affordable health care. Every now and then, I find an item in the paper and think, that's perfect for the Dubious Achievement Awards. Here's one from my local rag a few days ago. I will summarize the beginning of Jeff Jacoby's column. Saudi Arabia sentenced liberal Muslim blogger Raif Badawi to a fine of $250,000 plus 10 years in prison plus 1,000 lashes with a whip for the crime of insulting Islam on his blog. On January 9, the government delivered the first installment of his public flogging, giving him 50 lashes. 19 more installments to go. 2 days later, following the Charlie Hebdo murders, the Saudi ambassador joined the Great Paris Solidarity March in defense of freedom of expression. Where are the Dubious Achievement Awards now that we really need them? Surely the Keystone Pipeline would win a Dubious Achievement Award. Let's see if I've got this right. At an extremely large cost per barrel, they're mining the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, at great environmental cost, for some really dirty, low-quality, oil-filled glop. And they want to build a pipeline for the glop all across the United States to carry the filthy glop to refineries near the Gulf of Mexico. The pipeline company involved is famous for leaks, spills, and other ecological disasters. Why are they piping the crap from Canada all the way across the United States down to refineries in the sunny Gulf of Mexico? Because when they refine the stuff into gasoline and other petroleum products, they're going to immediately load the product onto tanker ships and carry it off to be sold in Europe, South America, and Africa. The cold warriors of the Obama administration love the project because selling the oil in Europe will hurt Russia. Almost none of the stuff from the tar sands will benefit anyone in North America in any way, except the oil company stockholders. Okay, sounds like a plan. Where are the Dubious Achievement Awards now that we really need them? David Rovics can explain the pipeline better than I can. Here he is.
As soon as they started drilling for oil, they started building pipelines on the seabed through the forests and across the border lines. As soon as they started laying the pipe, they said, we'll do this safely. There will never be an accident. We can do this carefully. But the sands shift, the ice melts, disasters are routine. Point out their record of destruction, and they'll say their hands are clean. Point out their woeful deeds, and they'll consult their banker and say it's safer to use a pipeline than an oil tanker. So now they want to see how far their madness it can go. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. The tar sands lie in the north, beneath Alberta's ground. As the price of oil rises, the oil men have found. Now there's profit to be made in a madman's dream by drilling deep beneath earth, blasting it with steam, bulldozing the land, melting what's inside, a record of extinction 1,000 miles wide. But laying waste to the northern plains is evidently not enough. The capitalists need markets where they can sell this toxic stuff. So across the farms and prairies, the oil now must flow. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Governors oppose it. Every native band, ranchers don't want it passing through their land. Union leaders have denounced it, as have the rank and file. The president delayed it for just a little while. They say you can't stop progress. I hope that isn't true, cause if we mine the tar sands, if we let the pipeline through, it will be a pipeline to oblivion, a pipeline to the end, a pipeline to a future with nothing round the bend, a pipeline to a future that I hope we'll never know. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico.
David Rovix. And that's not even to mention global warming, caused in large measure by burning hydrocarbons. Which reminds me that the U.S. Senate just voted that global warming is not caused by burning hydrocarbons or anything else people have done. The Senate has now decided the issue, so it's all settled now, and we can stop worrying. What does the Senate think causes global warming, if not hydrocarbons? Probably Obamacare. Obamacare and gay marriage. And corporate taxes. And the teachers' union. Abolish those four, and we'll end all this nonsense about global warming once and for all. Where are the dubious achievement awards now that we really need them? We should give one to the Senate. Con Hallinan is a retired college professor, an essayist, blogger, and pundit. He's been filling in the gap with a more in-depth version of the annual Dubious Achievement Awards. He calls his awards the Are You Serious Awards. Last week's show replayed a couple of Hallinan's awards for the year 2011. Well, the new set is just out, covering the achievements of 2014, and let's hear a couple of those. These were published in Counterpunch on January 2nd. And I have edited them just a tad for radio. We'll hear a couple today and some more in later shows. That's a promise. But to start, some of the Are You Serious Awards for 2014 by Con Hallinan. The Golden Scold Award to Germany and Chancellor Angela Merkel for lecturing the Greeks on wasteful spending and forcing Athens to swallow crippling austerity measures, while at the same time bribing Greek military officials to spend billions of dollars on useless weapons. According to the Greek newspaper Katimerinai, arms dealers, mostly German, handed out close to $3 billion in bribes to secure $68 billion in weapons contracts from Greece over the next decade. With its people suffering under harsh austerity measures, Athens spent $2.3 billion to buy 170 German Leopard 2 tanks. Tanks which are largely useless for fighting in Greek terrain. The tanks were sent without ammunition, so Greece later coughed up $70 million to buy ammunition, also from a German company. The Greeks also paid more than $4 billion to purchase German U-214 submarines that are still in dry dock. From all accounts, these subs are very noisy. It is not good to be noisy in the silent service. According to Der Spiegel, the German company that makes the subs paid over $2 million in bribes to land the contract. In the meantime, the austerity policies forced on Greece by the International Monetary Fund, European Central Bank, and the European Union have impoverished millions of people. They have driven the unemployment rate to over 20%, 50% for those under age 25. Since 2008, Greek infant mortality has risen 21%, and child mortality is up 43%. Suicides are up 45%. In exchange for the $70 billion in new military spending, the Greeks got submarines that sit on the land, tanks they can't use, and lectures from Angela Merkel about saving money. Okay, here's another. Once again, the Golden Lemon Award goes to Lockheed Martin for its $1.5 trillion F-35 stealth fighter bomber, the most expensive weapon system in U.S. history. An airplane that can't get its software to work, won't fly in the rain, and burns up trying to get off the ground. The U.S. was forced to cancel the F-35's debut at a prestigious air show in Britain because a plane caught fire trying to take off from Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. The F-35 has since been restricted to lower speeds and 3 hours flying time, not enough to cross the Atlantic. Lockheed Martin and partner Austal USA also scored big in the lemon category with their littoral combat ships, or LCS, the USS Freedom and the USS Independence. The $37 billion LCS program will build a fleet of shallow draft high-speed warships. According to a recent Pentagon study, these ships will not survive combat. High Defense Department official Michael Gilmore says these ships are, quote, not expected to be survivable in a hostile combat environment and are not intended to be employed in a manner that puts them in harm's way, unquote. Translation, if they get in a fight, they're toast. But that might not be a problem because the ships require so much maintenance, they probably can't get to where the action is anyhow. Sidebar comment from me. I can't help noticing that the middle name of littoral combat ship is combat. Well, just don't take it literally, even though the name sort of invites you to. Littoral combat ship. Where are Abbott and Costello now that we really need them? No, Costello, it's not literally a combat ship. It's a literal combat ship. Abbott, what have you been drinking, and where can I get some? Of course, the literal is spelled L-I-T-T-O-R-A-L. The word means seashore. The perfect vessel for the next time we attack the beaches of Normandy, or Fort Lauderdale, or more likely, the shores of Tripoli. Except the ship isn't designed to withstand combat. Hit it with 2 9-millimeter bullets from a Glock handgun and down it goes. Fortunately, it's the seashore, so the water isn't very deep. Think of all the lives that will save. All the sailors who will not drown when the ship goes down. Of course, there's still that guy on the beach with the Glock they have to worry about. Your tax dollars at work. $37 billion. What would national health care cost? But back to the text. How about the Mouse That Roared Award to the Marshall Islands for hauling the nuclear-armed powers, the U.S., China, Russia, France, Britain, Pakistan, India, Israel, and North Korea before the International Court of Justice at The Hague for violating Article 6 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? Article 6 requires the nuclear powers to begin disarming. Not all the countries named have in fact ratified the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But it's hard to argue with the Marshall Islanders on the subject of nukes. In 1954, the U.S. vaporized Bikini Atoll with a 15-megaton hydrogen bomb and irradiated thousands of islanders. Over a period of 12 years, the U.S. detonated some 67 nuclear warheads with an aggregate explosive power of 42.2 megatons in the Marshalls. By comparison, the Hiroshima bomb was 15 kilotons. Sidebar comment, that is, the United States clobbered the Marshall Islands with the equivalent of 3,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs. Back to the text. The Marshall Islands Nuclear Claims Tribunal found the U.S. liable for $2 billion in damages. So far, Washington has paid out only $150 million. It wasn't just the Marshall Islanders who got zapped. Heavily contaminated U.S. Navy ships stationed in the Marshall Islands were scrapped and buried around the San Francisco area, including at Treasure Island. Then, at Treasure Island, a 2,000-unit low-income housing project was built on top of this radioactive waste. Government authorities assured the residents there that there is nothing to worry about. Then they warned residents not to let their children dig in their front yards or backyards. "Look, Mom, this rock glows in the dark." Radiation, the gift that keeps on giving. And there, let us pause our reading of Con Hallinan's Are You Serious Awards for 2014. Just out, just published this January 2015. Esquire's dubious achievement awards are gone, but their spirit lives on in Are You Serious Awards and in New World Notes. And thank you for listening. You'll find an archive of all our broadcasts at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimi non carborundum. Always look on the bright side of life, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today on the show, you'll hear the second and final part of an interview with Dr. Graham McQueen. Graham McQueen wrote an article about the results of a recent poll in the UK, part of which focused on Muslims' beliefs about 9/11. So this is the second part of that interview about this article, which was called 9/11 Truth, British Muslims Overwhelmingly Reject the Official 9/11 Story. And this was published on the website globalresearch.ca on December 29th, 2016. Graham McQueen was the founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, where he taught for 30 years. He is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. McQueen holds a PhD in Buddhist Studies from Harvard University. He's the author of the book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, which came out in 2014, and he was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings in 2011. And he's a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. So let's begin with the second part of that interview. We pick up where Graham is talking about some of the terms that were used in the British poll.
So extremism is a term that's under debate in the UK for good reason. I think it should be rejected completely. But part of the reason it's being defined that way is because the people in government who are pushing this notion of extremism do not want it to be, how shall I put this, they do not want violence to be an essential part of the definition. If extremism were to mean what many people assume it means, that people are doing some kind of horrible, unjustified violence, then obviously Sherrold and Graham McQueen aren't extremists, because we're not pushing violence. But they want us to be part of that circle, just like they want British Muslims as a whole to be in danger of this thing called extremism. So they are deliberately creating a category, and they say this, like when he was Prime Minister, Cameron publicly said that he was against all forms of extremism, including, folks, nonviolent extremism. That's his term. And what we see in this poll that I'm discussing here is that the current effort by the political right in the UK is to make so-called conspiracy theories, generally undefined, okay, to make that a part of this thing called nonviolent extremism.
Yes, it's an attack on anybody who challenges the official story.
Absolutely, an attack which has a very scary direction here, because what they're really heading for, and they've got legislation in the works in the UK, is to not only make so-called conspiracy theorists, you know, like us, to not only make us taboo and somehow polluted and ridiculous and all those things which they've been trying to do all along, but to actually make it illegal to hold such opinions. It's something we need to be aware of this.
I agree, and they're also trying to attack the, quote, fake news. They're trying to get at all the alternative outlets where we can share this information. And there's talk of trying to make, quote, fake news illegal, too. So, yeah, it is a major attack. I see that. I'm glad you're bringing that up.
Yeah, it's a dangerous assault which needs to be checked. And unfortunately, mainstream media, political parties have had a fair bit of success in the West in this employment of terms like conspiracy theory. And so it's possible that they'll get some fishy law through a parliament here or there that will make it much harder for us to have freedom of expression and freedom of research and to find out and communicate the truth about our times.
I see that as a very serious attack on us also, and I'm not sure that everyone grasps that in our movement, that they understand how serious that is.
I think you're right. I think people in what's generally called the 9/11 truth movement are used to being ridiculed, but I'm not sure that most of them grasp that there's a serious attempt, and it's an international attempt, because it's going on simultaneously in several countries. It's going on in the UK, it's going on in the US, it's going on in my country, Canada, to try and make these things illegal. My colleague Tony Hall at the University of Lethbridge was suspended without pay from his job as a tenured professor just a couple of months ago. And the charges, as far as I've seen them expressed, are vague, bordering on ridiculous. But one of them is that he engaged in conspiracy theories. Now think about that. A tenured university professor, because he engaged in conspiracy theories, he's being suspended.
And it's already starting.
Yeah, it's already starting. And so the movement definitely needs to wake up to this and to find ways of courageously and patiently doing what we have to do to fight this. So my little article, and I don't have any great hopes for that, it was a little spin-off article that I wrote while I was writing a longer piece on the political left in the West and its relationship to 9/11. Nonetheless, I wrote that little article and I thought, wow, these findings are important. To me, maybe they'll be important to other people, too. So that's why I got it published on Global Research and hope people will read it and think about this.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on another element in the article that you talked about, where their argument, the people, the policy exchange people who did this poll, that their argument seems to go like this, that Muslim terrorist groups undertake violent acts because they think Muslims are under deadly assault from the West. And they sort of imply that they're being paranoid about this and it's not really happening. And I wondered
right.
if you could speak to that.
Yeah, that's a crucial argument that they use to link so-called conspiracy theorists to terrorism. They say that Muslim terrorists have been carrying out acts of terrorism because they have this worldview where Muslims are on one side as believers and the rest of the world is on the other side as unbelievers. Whole world's divided up into two. The unbelievers are carrying out an assault on the believers. In other words, especially the West led by the U.S., carrying out an assault on Islam and Muslims. Therefore, Muslims need to respond. And they claim that so-called conspiracy theories, like the 9/11 conspiracy theory, in quotation marks, play into all this because they feed the paranoia of the world's Muslims. You know, here's a great act of mass murder carried out in the U.S. that is portrayed as done by Muslims, but it wasn't really done by Muslims, say the conspiracy theorists, who in their political paranoia think that the West actually did this themselves and then blamed it on Muslims. And so through this kind of long argument, you can try and claim that the 9/11, let's call it 9/11 dissent, meaning disagreeing from the official account, feeds into terrorism. And that's the argument they make. And I'm saying this is absurd on so many levels. I mean, first of all, it's not a fantasy to say that there have been attacks on Muslims. My God, since the 9/11 attacks, several countries where the majority of the population is Muslim have been assaulted very violently. And if you read, there are several studies of casualties. I won't get into them, but the numbers of dead are in the millions. The numbers of wounded are in the many millions. The numbers of homeless are huge. We can't even begin to compute the number of people driven to clinical depression, anxiety, despair, PTSD. No. I mean, this is a horrendous crime. To call this political paranoia, excuse me? So what I say in my article is, in the real world, of course these assaults have happened. And when they say, oh, but it's paranoia to think that this was done as part of a nefarious intrigue. Well, it was nefarious, and it was an intrigue. And there were conspiracies. That's with the Downing Street memo and all this other stuff that has been discovered as about. I mean, you probably know the study by the Center for Public Integrity in the United States, which counted the hundreds and hundreds of lies told by top officials in the Bush administration in the lead-up to the attack on Iraq. So, yeah, of course, they did conspire. They did lie. It was a nefarious intrigue. So then the question becomes, do Muslims have the right to respond? And I say in the article, of course they do. Now, how they respond is another matter. It doesn't have to be violent. And in fact, British Muslims clearly are not interested in that kind of response, according to this poll. But there are lots of ways you can respond to something without being violent, and they have every right to respond. My God. So again, I just think this is such a crude, ideologically driven poll, the way they've put it together. And of course, you and I should be helping Muslims to respond nonviolently but vigorously to all this slander and killing.
Yeah. And then the other term that I always find interesting is Islamophobia, like we all are afraid of them instead of having other more hatred or racist ideas going on.
Yeah, I think all the terms we use for different forms of racism need to be looked at carefully. Islamophobia has been a useful term, but it means fear of Islam, and there is fear going on for sure, but there's more than fear, right? There's suspicion, there's hatred, there's deception, there's blaming. So we need to think about all these terms and what are the best terms to use.
Right, and at the very least, there's scapegoating of them. So for the events of 9/11 and the global war on terror to keep functioning, they need to keep that going, that myth going.
Yes, I completely agree. The other point is that although this, the findings in the poll with British Muslims are not typical of the whole world, the polls that have been done, there's all kinds of polls on 9/11 that have been done all over the world for years now. And they're worth thinking about because what we're led to believe in Canada, and I'm pretty sure you're led to believe the same in the U.S., is that only nutty people and fringy people generally question the official account. The great majority of people, of course, accept the official account of 9/11. Of course they do. And the other people can be shoved to one side. Well, so while I was doing this article, I began looking at the other polls, and I just wanted to briefly give you my current estimates. So I think that the total percentage of the people in the world who are willing to come out and affirm the official account of 9/11 is probably around 39%, maybe 40. So in other words, out of 7.5 billion people in the world, about 2.9 billion accept the official narrative, probably. That's a maximum. I'm not making computations for who is a child and who's an adult here. That can all be done. These are crude figures. So what does that mean in terms of the people who are not willing to affirm the official account? Well, it's the great majority. 61%, roughly, of the world does not buy, yeah. Is not willing to say they buy. And that's 4.6 billion people, okay? Yeah, exactly. I mean, this really does, no matter how you interpret these figures, they certainly show that the official propagandists and mainstream media in the West have not had an unqualified success, all right? They've had success in the sense that they've managed to keep the fraud going so far. But as I often say to people, it's like holding up a lead Zeppelin. And here I'm not talking about the musical band. Uh-huh. I mean an actual, you know, big Zeppelin, a balloon made out of lead. It means what I'm trying to get at, it'll just fall down if you're not constantly working and expending energy to keep it up. And that's the official account of 9/11. It falls apart whenever you look at it. And therefore, it's like keeping that Led Zeppelin up in the air. It takes constant work.
That's why they have this attack on, quote, fake news, because they're trying to shut down anybody who's disagreeing with them because their propaganda isn't working as well in certain areas. And I think that's why they're so upset with Donald Trump, because they don't know what he, I don't think they have him under their control totally, and they don't know what he might uncover or reveal.
I agree with you on both points. Yeah, I agree with you on both points. I just find it bizarre at this point in history that I would say, yeah, well, who knows, maybe Trump will be,
I know.
Trump will do something good. I mean, this guy represents just about everything I fought against my whole life, right? But at the same time, it's sort of like, which imperialist do you choose? You guys weren't given very good choices. I mean, there was Bernie Sanders, but the Democratic Party, I mean, they seemed to be panicky at the thought that somebody who was actually interested in some interesting ideas might get in. So that they quickly destroyed his
Yeah, they rigged the primaries on that, of what the evidence seems to show. So, but now they've got Donald Trump, and I agree with you. I didn't vote for him, and I've worked against what he says all my life, too, but he's starting to say some interesting things, so who knows?
Yeah, especially on the whole, well, on several areas, but on Russia, if he's willing to have peaceful coexistence, my God, could prevent a nuclear war, for God's sake. For a different essay I have to write, I've been reading over stuff from my past and realizing how much of my adult life I spent wallowing in the Cold War and how great it was when that was temporarily over. But it wasn't over for long. You know, Russia didn't understand its role. Its role was to roll over and be dead and stay dead. And it didn't do that. And U.S. elites are so angry about that. What do you mean you're not dead? What do you mean you actually think you might have regional interests and some international influence? And so they're pushing and they're pushing and they're pushing. And they don't, I don't know whether they don't get how dangerous it is to keep pushing Russia, or whether they kind of get off in some ways on this danger they're putting the world into. I really don't pretend to understand.
If they really want a war with Russia, yeah, I don't understand that either. It seems pretty risky to me.
Very, very risky for everybody. Yeah. Do they really think that because their kids are in private schools and because they live in a gated community that they're safe from nuclear weapons? Because if they do, they're even stupider than I think. So, you know, if Trump can lower the rhetoric there, then that's a good thing. And at this point in history, our choices are usually not between good and bad. They're usually between bad and worse, and we have to make them accordingly.
Right, I agree with you. And then if Trump can really get rid of the trade agreements like NAFTA and the TPP and all of those, I think that would be a huge benefit also.
That's right. When I saw the other day that he seemed to be calling, unless I misunderstood the article, I had to read it several times, seemed to be calling for budget cuts in the CIA. I shouldn't be laughing. When you start interfering with the operation of the U.S. intelligence community, you're putting yourself at grave risk.
Yes, even Senator Chuck Schumer said on the news, which surprised me, he said that you don't want to criticize the CIA because they have many ways of getting back at you. So he was warning him. Well, Graham, is there anything else that you wanted to discuss or that I haven't asked you in relation to your article or anything else about 9/11 or the world?
As far as the polls go, this is just fine. Thank you.
Well, Graham McQueen, thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's always great to be here and have a chance to express some of these things.
And that does it for the interview with Dr. Graham McQueen on a recent article he wrote and which was posted on the highly recommended Canadian website, globalresearch.ca, on the results of a recent British poll in which only 4% of the Muslims in the UK believe the official government myth of what happened on 9/11. And now you're going to hear a short clip of Dr. Graham McQueen discussing evidence of foreknowledge of the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, the tower that was not hit by a plane on 9/11 and yet collapsed anyway.
People knew it was going to come down because they had been told that by people who were determined to bring it down. No such building has ever come down from office fires before at any time. And yet, it turns out there were people that knew within a couple of minutes of when it was going to come down. And they're on record saying, Ashley Banfield, one of the major journalists who was on the scene on World Trade 7, she basically points to the building, looks into the camera and said, I have been told that this building is the next one that's going to come down.
That building right there, the brown building, the tall one, is number 7 World Trade Center. I've heard several reports from several different officers now that that is the building that is going to go down next. In fact, one officer told me they're just waiting for that to come down at this point, that there's no way it's going to be recovered and there's no way that they can stabilize it.
CNN anchor Aaron Brown says there's another building at World Trade Center, which I've been told is either collapsing or has collapsed.
We are getting information now that one of the other buildings, Building 7 in the World Trade Center complex, is on fire and has either collapsed or is collapsing. You, to be honest, can see these pictures a little bit more clearly than I.
While CNN is showing World Trade 7 for about an hour after erroneously reporting its collapse, they have a caption at the bottom of the picture, World Trade 7 on fire, may collapse, which looks so kind of normal and reasonable that I think most viewers would think, okay, well, here's a building, it's on fire, it may collapse, what's the problem? What the viewers haven't been told at that point is that no such building, no such steel-framed skyscraper in history had ever collapsed from fire. So it's not normal at all. World Trade 7 on fire may collapse. And World Trade Center 7 coming down from fire is just unheard of. So that's why I refer to this as normalizing the abnormal, you know, trying to make it look normal and reasonable when in fact it's unprecedented, it's outlandish. I mean, if it's true that World Trade 7 came down from office fire, there are just hundreds and hundreds, I suppose thousands and thousands of buildings in the world that are at risk of total disaster. And we have to be worried and we have to change the engineering curriculum in universities and the building codes and everything. And of course, we haven't, because I think the authorities are perfectly aware that it didn't come down from office fire. The BBC anchor says, you know, we're now going to confirm what we told you a couple of minutes before, namely that the Solomon Brothers building at the World Trade Center, and that's another name for World Trade 7, has indeed collapsed.
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago, I was talking about the Solomon Brothers building collapsing.
And then he says, we'll go to Jane Stanley, our reporter at the scene, for more. And there's Jane.
Jane, what more can you tell us about the Solomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy.
Solemnly confirming what he says, and she's standing right in front of World Trade 7, which is clearly, it hasn't collapsed and it isn't collapsing. When this video was discovered, I think it was 2007, and widely spread on the internet, it was quite a scandal. So the head of BBC had to eventually reply, and he said, well, if we reported this before it happened, I can assure you it's not because we were part of some conspiracy. It was not because we were told in advance of its collapse that it was going to come down. If this happened, then we can assure you it was simply an error and nothing else. For a whole bunch of reasons, it doesn't work to say this was an error. When we're asking whether Building 7 may have been deliberately brought down on 9/11, whether it might have been subjected to controlled demolition, we get called a lot of names. We're conspiracy theorists and we're overthinking simple situations, so on and so forth. But of course, we know that the option of deliberately bringing that building down was discussed on 9/11. It's not like we made this up. There is, for example, an interview with, I believe it's a Lieutenant Restuccio in the Fire Department of New York. This is just after Building 7 comes down, and the journalist says to him, so that was Building 7 that came down, and Restuccio says, yes, indeed, it was.
Can you confirm it was number 7 that just went in?
Yes, sir.
And you guys knew this was coming all day.
We had heard reports that the building was unstable and that it eventually would either come down on its own or it would be taken down. I would imagine it came down on its own.
Obviously, it had been discussed during the day, the possibility of bringing it down, which is why he can't exclude that option as one possibility. When people are trying to defend the official narrative of World Trade 7's collapse, they generally try to make it sound as if, well, people had a hunch, or they were worried, or they made a rational prediction that it might come down. And I'm saying none of those words, prediction, hunch, and so on, is good enough. What we actually have is foreknowledge. When we use the term foreknowledge, we should be careful, and I include three criteria. The first is what you might call a subjective state in the person who's knowing. You have to feel certain. You have to feel a high degree of confidence. So, for example, if you say, well, you know, I'm worried about that building. I have a hunch something bad might happen to it. And that's not good enough to use the term foreknowledge. But if you say, oh, it's definitely coming down, that fulfills the criterion of certainty. Second criterion is what I call confirmation. The thing you claim to know has to actually happen. Otherwise, we don't usually use the word knowledge. Even if a person was certain, we would say, well, they had a false belief or they had unjustified confidence. But if I say, I'm confident Building 7 is coming down, and lo and behold, Building 7 does come down, that's confirmation. That means my confidence was justified. And the third criterion is detail. And by that, I just mean that your knowledge of, let's say, when or the conditions under which this event is going to happen has to be fairly precise for us to use the term foreknowledge. Once we've established that there was foreknowledge of World Trade 7's collapse, by that I mean the records are quite good. We know there were a lot of people who are completely confident it was coming down. In fact, we're told there were hundreds of firefighters who were standing around for hours, and the way they put it is we were waiting for World Trade 7 to come down. In other words, they had been told it was definitely coming down. So we know this. So there was confidence. There was confirmation. The building did come down. And there was precision. We have, again, very good records. We know that it was known within a few minutes when it was going to come down. And that's quite extraordinary because, of course, no steel skyscraper in history had ever come down from fire before. Remember, this building wasn't hit by a plane. So if this is an unprecedented event, it's never happened before, and yet people are able to say within a few minutes when it was going to come down, you see what I'm saying? This is fishy, and these three criteria, confidence, confirmation, and detail, have been met.
Keep your eye on that building. It'll be coming down.
Now, once we've established that, we say, well, what are the kinds of foreknowledge that exist? And I make a distinction between two broad kinds of foreknowledge. One is evidence-based foreknowledge, and one is action-based foreknowledge. Evidence-based foreknowledge just means, you know, you look around and you gather evidence that something is going to happen, and then you make a prediction. So we could call that, if it's confirmed and is given with a lot of detail and confidence, we could call it foreknowledge. And it would be evidence-based, and there's nothing fishy about it. It happens. The second kind of foreknowledge is action-based. And all I mean by that is that the person knows something is going to happen because they're going to act to make it happen. Or, alternatively, they're aware of somebody else who's going to act to make it happen. So if I say, I know I'm going to be sitting at my desk at 8:15 tomorrow morning, I know that because I'm going to make a point of acting in such a way that I'm at my desk at 8:15. And that's a different kind of foreknowledge. And there's nothing fishy about that either. It's very common. It's great. It's not no problem. But it can be a problem if somebody misrepresents the kind of foreknowledge that's at issue. So if I say that I'm acting on evidence-based foreknowledge when that's impossible, then we have a problem. NIST, when it came out with its final study on World Trade 7, it said, no, it didn't come down because of storage of fuel tanks in the building. It didn't come down because of damage from World Trade 1. It came down from office fire and fires that were presumably caused by the collapse of the other buildings. And they led to a whole string of really unique, peculiar events. This long span girder and this column, and one thing heats up and it pushes another thing off its seat, and that leads to this and that. And this whole strange sequence of events, which was invisible to the eye of anyone looking at the building, it all took place within the structure of the building, took place really at the very last moment, within a few minutes or even a few seconds of the actual initiation of the collapse. So that's the official government explanation of why World Trade 7 came down. There were fires. They led to peculiar, unique events that happened at the last moment. But if that's true, what point is there in talking about what some engineer thought around noon on the day, you know, 5.5 hours before the building came down, or what firefighters might have thought? And to just sum this up, what I'm saying about Building 7 is that the official government investigators are trying to get us to believe that an evidence-based prediction had been made, that there was evidence and there was a rational conclusion that Building 7 might come down, whereas in fact, when we study it carefully, we see that that does not fly. It's impossible. That in fact, we are led to the conclusion that it must have been action-based foreknowledge. Or to put it bluntly, people knew it was going to come down because they had been told that by people who were determined to bring it down. So in other words, this foreknowledge, this particular kind of foreknowledge, supports the hypothesis that World Trade 7 was brought down by controlled demolition.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land. Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor, that twin city's frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my light beside the golden door. Emma Lazarus.
But for people who were dragooned here, brought in chains, but for the indigenous people, we are all immigrants. And indeed, the wretched refuge of the teeming shores to be brought here. But we have a new administration. And President Trump ordered an end to the Obama-era executive action that shields young undocumented immigrants from deportation, calling the program, quote, an amnesty first approach, end quote, and urging Congress to replace it with legislation before it begins phasing out on March 5th, 2018. I do not favor punishing children, most of whom are now adults, for the action of their parents, Mr. Trump said in a written statement. But he said the United States is a nation of opportunity because we are a nation of laws. The statement was released shortly after Mr. Trump, who had called the issue a personal dilemma, dispatched Attorney General Jeff Sessions to announce that the government will no longer accept new applications from undocumented immigrants to shield them from deportation under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DACA. Administrative officials said that the roughly 800,000 current beneficiaries of the program brought to the United States without papers as children will not be immediately affected by what they called an orderly wind down of former President Barack Obama's policy. Well, we're joined now by Oscar Chacon, co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas, formerly known as National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities, an umbrella of immigrant-led and immigrant-serving organizations based in the United States of America, dedicated to improving the quality of life of Latino immigrant communities in the U.S., as well as of people throughout the Americas. And Jiajia Wang, the organizing and advocacy director for the American Friends Service Committee Immigrant Rights Program, whose goal is to achieve policies that respect the rights and dignity of all immigrants, including a fair and humane national immigration policy. The Immigrants' Rights Program's successful integration of legal services, advocacy, and organizing has made a dramatic difference in the lives of immigrants, ensuring that immigrant voices are heard in policy debates by assisting immigrants with challenging immigration cases and by changing the narrative about immigration issues to influence policy. And our dreamer, Isaac, a deferred action for childhood arrival, a DACA beneficiary, has agreed to be with us to tell his story and put a human face on those who dream on this country, on this American of African descent. We are particularly pleased that he has agreed to be with us. And I thank all of you. And I want to begin with our dreamer, with Isaac. Perhaps you can tell us your story to help set the pace for the rest of our discussion. SOS this morning on responding with humanity and consideration and welcoming to our immigrant sisters and brothers from every area of the globe. Isaac, thank you for being with us. Your story, please.
Thank you, Mimi. My name is Isaac Opong. I'm a DACA recipient. I am 29 years old. I came from Ghana to U.S. age of 15 years. At 2003. I live at Newark, New Jersey. I was undocumented with 3 kids. My life was always in a bad and poor condition and fears of police eyes and deportation. And I can't even just go to work to put food and water on the table for my family to eat and drink. I always stressful and depressed. But I've been here for more than 5 years until DACA came to my point and I qualified. And USCIS Immigration have approved my DACA 2 years and renewed when it expired 2019. DACA came to my life and released all my stress, depressed. DACA make me bring food and water on the table for my families. DACA protect me from deportation. DACA gives me a job and education and stay without fear. DACA make me pay my taxes all the time. DACA, I feel upset about DACA. I'm not comfortable about how many brave young people in this country have DACA will be affected. About 800,000 to 1 million brave young people. This is a lot of impact and weight, and we can contribute to our state taxes without fear of deportation. Ending DACA is cruel and un-American. We must pass a Clean Dream Act to protect these brave young people. Washington and congressmen, DACA is real. Moving forward with DACA. And President Trump's idea about DACA is a huge backwards. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to share my life story with you. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for being here and sharing your talents, your aspirations, your love, as a member of this country. And Shasha, you were the one who introduced me to Isaac. And Isaac would seem to me to be an icon for all of the young dreamers. I saw thousands of them lining up where I work at the Legal Aid Society to apply for DACA. Talk about what the significance of the DACA program is for people like Isaac and the other people that have come and sought your services with the American Friends Service Committee to stay in this country and to become documented and not subject to deportation to countries that, by and large, they don't know at all.
I think, you know, I'm still really shocked by President's announcement and this policy. I think it's ill-spirited and that, you know, it basically closed the door of America to a lot of young people that deserve to stay and that have made this country their home. I can tell you stories that I heard yesterday, you know, how DACA gives them a glimpse of hope. It's the beginning and should be the beginning of their bright future, not the end. This is a basic standard and or protection that we can provide to these young people. And even that, you know, the president did not want to continue with the program. That's extremely disappointing and has devastating impact on the young people. And we're talking about more than a million people being affected, the young people and their families and the future young people that could qualify for this program. ISAC is right. You know, we need a permanent solution. The U.S. Congress can help in this whole, you know, broken system. So once this protection or a shield of deportation from deportation is taken away, these young people will be or would become undocumented again, and that, you know, they could be subject to detention and deportation. And we all know that the local, federal, and, well, basically county government and private prison company have been profiting from this detention and deportation machine, and that they could be playing a role in, you know, making this happen. There's no doubt that the president has a lot of relationship with different companies. Also, recognizing that this is more than just a simple program, and it's a small solution or relief of a bigger problem, and that with all these factors and reasons why we are as a country still maintaining or keeping this big, you know, detention deportation machine, we as citizens must understand the reasons and then and understand the human impact of DACA being taken away and of the Congress not passing any kind of meaningful immigration policy.
Oscar Chacon. So the president, he walks it back a little bit with a tweet, but he throws this grenade in the middle of this inept Congress, this contentious, even though he controls the party. What should we understand about the politics of Trump's position, and what does it really mean to toss this grenade of DACA to the Congress? And we'll get in, of course, to the broader discussion about people who are here on TPS status and what that means for Haitians and Salvadorans and Hondurans as well. There's a whole trilogy of groups that are immediately affected within the next months by the possibility of detention and deportation. Oscar, your concerns about and your understanding of what just happened politically with the DACA program.
The announcement represents a major accomplishment by what we understand to be the most extremist, racist leaders within, you know, this particular administration. It's important to remember that the very person who made the announcement, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, as well as Stephen Miller, these are individuals who come from a truly extremist perspective on the question of immigration to the United States. I mean, they frankly believe there should be no more people coming in, either immigrants or refugees. I mean, that's their basic point of departure, because they believe that the immigration of the past 30, 40 years has actually been some sort of intoxicating factor into American society, an American society that they believe should be primarily white, primarily European. And therefore, when you look at who the newcomers have been over the past 40 or so years, you can clearly see why they despise so strongly the very people who have become part of the mosaic of cultures, races, identities that make up the United States of America. I believe that the announcement again represents essentially an important step in that direction. And by telling us all, telling the country that this should be something Congress should address, they are essentially saying something that is hard to believe, because this is the very Congress who has systematically neglected their duty in terms of constantly reforming U.S. immigration policies in order for it to be in sync with the reality of human mobility, the reality of refugees displacement in today's world. The real solution should be the passing of a Clean Dream Act bill that specifically addresses the situation of the young people that were the intended beneficiaries of the deferred action that President Obama took back in 2012. However, we believe that the real intention of this move is to create a situation where a sort of compromise should be reached, knowing perfectly well that just a few weeks ago, President Trump embraced very openly and warmly a proposal that was filed in the U.S. Senate, essentially seeking a major restrictive revision of U.S. immigration policy in what is known as the Cotton-Perdue bill. That's a bill that would, from the get-go, say that they want to cut back U.S. annual immigration numbers from about 1 million today to 500,000 in a matter of 10 years. And they also want to cut back significantly the number of refugees from about 110 or so thousand a year to no more than 50,000 a year within a short period of time. So we believe that this is the agenda that they are actually pursuing. And again, it is important to be fully aware that both Jeff Sessions, Stephen Miller, and a few others, I mean, that are part of their advisory team, again, come from the very forces that about 30 years ago set themselves in motion to come to a point where we are today, which is to essentially restrict immigration. And again, the suffering that this may cause on recipients of DACA, or, for example, the case of the Haitians, which just a few months ago were given a six-month extension on their TPS program, and is now scheduled to end early in January, is perhaps, I mean, the beginning of this particular set of events that we are seeing now, and we must do everything we can to ensure that these protections remain in place. We must also do everything we can to prepare for a push for legislation that addresses only these injustices that are built into our immigration system today. But we also need to prepare for adequate legal protection for people who are going to, again, be affected if these programs indeed come to an end and nothing better comes in to replace it.
I want to go back to Isaac and ask what you've expressed quite beautifully and quite movingly, what being a beneficiary of DACA has meant to you. What does it mean to live under the threat of detention and deportation? And what would it mean to you? And what do you think the loss of this country would be if people like yourselves, who have only known this country, were forced to leave it? Isaac?
DACA, I've been benefiting from DACA because I was under the shadow when I didn't receive no DACA or no eligible or approved for immigration. So my life was so risky, not comfortable at all. But since I've met a DACA in my life, the whole my entire life started to be changing and make me feel more comfortable, bring me from under the shadow into the light. So now I can go to take my medication. I take medication. I go to work, and then I pay my rent. Before, I can't afford even my rent every month.
What are you studying?
Right now, I'm learning. I'm trying to obtain my high school diploma and go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Adult school education, so I can get my high school diploma and continue my education to college. So I'm studying all the subjects. I'm studying English, math, science, algebra, African American history, biology, chemistry, all the subjects.
What would it mean for you if you were sent back to Ghana, a home that you barely know?
If they send me back to Ghana, it'd be a very tough situation for me. My life wouldn't be come back. I can't come back to my life anymore, normal life anymore, because about 90% of Ghanaians don't have a job. So how am I going to live my life? That means my life is going to be jeopardy. So why I'm still here, why I can't stay here and protected by the government of the United States and give me every opportunity as equal right to everyone, every human mankind, instead to send me or send the millions of people going back home, what they're going to do over there? Since they've been staying here for many years and become a member and family and friends of Americans. So we stay here, we live here, we go to school here, work here. So here's our home. We have nowhere to go, no place to go. So if you send me, that means you're going to jeopardize my life more than anything else. And I can't do nothing in Ghana. Here I know, here I live, here I stay. So that's the only thing I can survive. My life is here, United States of America. So it has more benefit to me for DACA. If they took the DACA away, my life would be jeopardy completely.
Georges, you work with many, many people like Isaac. Your thoughts on the imperative of continuing, and how do you see taking on the struggle to continue the DACA program and to also respond to what Asghar has raised, which is the jeopardy to the Haitian population who were given TPS status after the devastating earthquake, etc. And I know that there is similar jeopardy to groups of Salvadorians and Hondurans. Can you talk about that as well?
Yeah, I can certainly take that, because, you know, my agency actually provides legal services to a lot of Central Americans who got temporary protected status back in the late 90s and early 2000. That is the Hondurans, Nicaraguans, and Salvadorians. My program actually started by working for and working with them when they left their country because of war, because hurricane disaster, and decided to settle New Jersey. So it's been over 17 years. They've come to this country. They have developed roots. They have had families. They have children born here, or they raise their children here. And the country conditions have not become better. And the truth is that these temporary protected status, they don't allow people who have been here for 17 years to become, to get permanent, to obtain permanent residency. That's the fallacy of this system, is that it does not have any flexibility. It's basically counter humanity, that we need to revisit the system. We need to fix the system. Because it's likely that president may do something to temporary protected status people, and that if so, and they lost their status, they have to return home. They're returning home to a country that have really not too much to return to. They will have to decide whether to leave their children here or take their children back home with them. So I think it's a very inhumane and cruel decision that one has to make. And then our government will be forcing them to make that decision. And that's absolutely not acceptable. So, you know, we are looking at, you know, terminating all these temporary programs and then shut the door again to immigrants who have made America their home. We all need to really question whether that's okay.
And also,
one thing I can add, Mimi, is that it's important to keep in mind that the justification that is often given for why we should become heartless, hard on immigrants, is because it is said that immigrants take away jobs from Americans. I mean, this was one of the arguments raised yesterday by Jeff Sessions. And I really believe that the measures to harm immigrants like DACA recipients or TPS recipients are really better understood as distractions from the problems that affect, broadly speaking, almost everyone in the United States when you think about the fact that economic inequality has become such an incredibly harming reality where most of the wealth generated in a country like ours and the income that is actually earned goes to a very small percentage of the population. So there are indeed economic pains that broad segments of the population are feeling, but they have nothing to do with the arrival of foreign nationals into the country in a nation that has an immigration law that has not really been updated in a wise, truly compassionate manner since at least 1965. And so it's important to understand that you could well treat all these people, namely DACA recipients, TPS recipients, badly, but that will not cure, you know, the problem of economic inequality and the fear that that generates in broad segments of the U.S. population. And so it's important for us also to call out these rather mean ways of trying to use the opinion of people who may well be hurting economically because of this reality of economic injustice that we live by essentially punishing people who are also victims of that very same system.
And
may I ask a little bit of contribution, please?
Please.
Absolutely. Okay. My contribution is I know America is a nation of immigrants, and the immigrant is the one brought a nation, and immigrants contributing economy to rebuild economy and bring infrastructure to the country. So there's more ways. Even a sea always want to rain or always receive a rain in the sea. So the immigrants are human. Immigrants is a human. And human always is produced by nature, God, creation. So you can't reject human. And meanwhile, you need economy to rebuild. And economy can't break by itself without human. So who are the immigrants? Some like me. I'm here. I'm immigrant. I work and pay my taxes to rebuild the economy of the state of my state. So if more creation jobs available, nobody take away no jobs. Job is everywhere. And even the job will be full of our hands. And that's what we're looking for, the very good leadership to promote jobs, creation, education, reinfrastructure the nation. So many things are available to do or focus on it. Not about those who've been already received or been approved our state of our governance of the immigration for DACA. It's been already approved. Why are we moving backwards instead of moving forward? And a lot of times we need to move forward to achieve it and not moving backwards. Because backwards, there's nothing good in backwards.
In the last 30 seconds, Oscar Chacon, what is to be done? How do we support our sister and brother immigrants, people like Isaac, who is an American of African descent? What is to be done?
Well, I mean, I really believe that there are three main tasks that we need to undertake in the short term. One is to insist on keeping these populations protected. Bottom line is the president does have the authority to provide protection, just like President Obama did. Any notion that this is unconstitutional is simply not true. Number two, we need to fight pressure very strongly for legislative solutions that are specific to these particular cases and not bargaining chips to try to get away with some sort of immigration reform that would only make the law as it is worse than it already has been for many, many years. And number three, we also need to be thinking of how do we seek legal protection mechanisms that allow these populations not to be left out in the cold if these programs do come to an end as they are now scheduled to be. So those to me are like critical tasks that we need to undertake immediately.
And we'll continue to explore those and how they unfold and how we can get involved. We've been speaking with Zha Zha Wang, the Organizing and Advocacy Director of the American Friends Service Committee Immigration Rights Program, Oscar Chacon, co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas, and our dreamer, Isaac, a deferred action for childhood arrival, a DACA beneficiary. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
This new directive requires the military to discriminate against transgender people.
The courts indicated at that time that they thought this was unconstitutional.
It's galvanizing so much strength and resilience and hope from a lot of people around us. And it's the personal stories that remind everybody that we are human beings and that we deserve to be loved.
This is not about love. This is about whether people are free to believe that marriage is between a man and a woman and whether we're allowed to say that out loud.
Marriage equality! We want no less! How are you going to vote?
Yes, yes, yes!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Wedding dreams come true for Maltese gays and lesbians, Legal Eagles target Trump's trans ban, and the marriage plebiscite debate gets down and dirty down under. Their stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Wendell Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 2nd, 2017. Maltese gay and lesbian couples began entering into civil matrimony on September 1st when the marriage equality bill that passed in the legislature on July 12th took effect. It was the first item on the agenda of the newly installed Labour government since the June national elections and fulfilled a campaign promise. Lawmakers allowed time for appropriate government documents and procedures to be updated to accommodate same-gender couples. For example, changes to the Marriage Act included replacing references to husband and wife with spouse, and in extending adoption rights to same-gender couples, replacing mother or father with parent. Malta becomes the 23rd nation in the world to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples, setting up what is sure to be the country's best ever celebration of LGBTQ pride on September 9th. German couples are expected to begin walking down the aisle by early October, when marriage equality legislation there takes effect to bring that total to 24.
But Israel's Supreme Court rejected a civil marriage equality lawsuit on August 31st that had been brought by one of the country's leading LGBT advocacy groups. The justices decided that it was not an appropriate concern for the judiciary, but a political issue for lawmakers to deal with. They also unanimously rejected the petition's claim that denying marriage to same-gender couples violates Israel's basic law on human dignity and liberty. The verdict pointed out that there is no such thing as civil marriage in the country. Israeli law only recognizes marriages conducted by religious authorities. For that reason, the court said it could not rule on the petition because it is a civil court. Of course, there are no known Jewish, Muslim, or Christian clerics in Israel who will officiate the wedding of a same-gender couple. And even some heterosexuals are behind a movement in the country to create non-religious civil marriage for both opposite and same-gender couples. According to the Times of Israel, recent polling suggests that at least 3 in 4 Israelis support opening marriage to lesbian and gay couples, but marriage equality legislation has yet to gain traction in parliament.
Calling Samoa
a Christian country, Prime Minister Tule Epua Salelea Malilenori said this week that as long as he and his ironically named Human Rights Protection Party remain in power, abortion will remain illegal and marriage will remain exclusively heterosexual on the South Pacific Island nation, which is home to about 171,000 people. He rejected the recommendations of a Samoan HIV/AIDS prevention panel that the government legalize both abortion and marriage equality. The Prime Minister said that abortion is murder and similar to giving our women the license to kill. He called opening civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples absolutely against our religious Christian values and beliefs, and that it undermines our tradition and our culture. I pray that this is the last time that these issues are brought to the government and my attention, he added, because it's a useless waste of government stationery and time to acknowledge or even to respond to such suggestions.
But Chilean President Michelle Bachelet introduced a bill in Congress this week to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. The measure also extends adoption rights to them. Chile decriminalized gay sex in 1999 and created less than equal civil unions for lesbian and gay couples in 2015. Opinion polls indicate that a majority of Chileans now support marriage equality. The Movement for Homosexual Integration and Liberation won a lawsuit it filed in 2012 at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on behalf of three Chilean same-gender couples seeking the right to marry. Bachelet's government agreed to submit a marriage and adoption bill as part of an agreement it reached with a group in June 2016. The introduction of the marriage equality bill comes a week after Chile's constitutional court upheld a measure that relaxes the country's total ban on abortions, making exceptions for rape, when the mother's life is in danger, or when the fetus is not viable. Analysts say that Bachelet is unlikely to be able to get a marriage equality bill through Congress before her term expires in March, but queer advocates applauded her for taking an important step toward that goal. In announcing her initiative in a ceremony at the Presidential Palace, attended by several LGBTQ rights activists, Bachelet said that we can't let old prejudices be stronger than love.
In other news, Chechen strongman Ramzan Kadyrov continues to try to turn back the clock in Russia's mostly Muslim region. Now that he thinks he's successfully purged all gay and bisexual men from Chechnya, though he also at one time said that there were no such people there, he's ordering Chechens who have divorced to remarry, even if that means that men will have multiple wives. According to some reports, more than 1,000 couples have already complied. Kadyrov has no problem with a man having more than one wife. He's strongly supported polygamy in public pronouncements, claiming that it helps prevent men from cheating. But an anonymous divorced Chechen man complained to the BBC about being pressured to remarry. Why do they have to cling to the past, he asked, when they can have a future?
A nonprofit charitable group based in Toronto, known as the Rainbow Railroad, announced this week that it has helped 37 LGBT people escape from Chechnya and that 31 of them had already arrived in Canada. The group's executive director, Kamali Powell, explained in a media statement that the operation had been kept secret to ensure the safety of the refugees and their families back home. He said that his group had established a partnership with the Canadian government to expedite visas and that he went to Russia in May to meet with some of the asylum seekers. He called the effort to exterminate gay and bisexual men in Chechnya, which began in April, part of a global pattern of ongoing state-enabled or state-sanctioned violence against LGBTQ people. Powell said that the Rainbow Railroad has also teamed up with the in-country Russian LGBT network, which provides safe houses and channels of communication to refugee seekers until his group can arrange for their evacuation. He said Rainbow Railroad has helped a total of 140 LGBTQ people escape persecution in their homeland so far this year. According to the global queer rights group, ILGA, same-gender lovemaking is still a crime in 72 countries around the world. In a number of predominantly Muslim countries, such as Iran, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, and Yemen, it can be punished by execution.
The Canadian government joined a handful of other countries around the world this week in offering a non-binary gender designation of X on their passports. Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Ahmed Hussein said in a media statement that all Canadians should feel safe to be themselves, live according to their gender identity, and express their gender as they choose. Adrian Smith, a Toronto immigration lawyer who specializes in transgender issues, told Global News that she's thrilled about the option to have a gender-neutral passport. But she cautioned that with it comes potential problems. Any foreign country has the right to refuse entry to any visitor, she said. An X-gender designation on a person's passport could lead to arrest or worse in countries with documented records of anti-LGBTQ persecution like Uganda and Jamaica. Australia, one of the few other countries that offers the X-gender option on its passports, actually cautions travelers about using them in potentially hostile places. Smith and at least a few others think that gender designation of any type is no longer necessary. We now have biometric passports, she said. We have fingerprints, and we have other much more secure forms of establishing identity.
And finally, Canada's top military officer made a bit of queer history on August 27th when he joined Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in the LGBTQ Pride Parade in Ottawa. Trudeau has marched in several Pride parades this year, but Army General Jonathan Vance, Chief of Staff of the Canadian Armed Forces, became the highest-ranking military official to ever celebrate Pride in Canada's federal capital. He said earlier in the day that he wanted to show solidarity with members of the queer community and perhaps thumbing his nose at U.S. President Donald Trump's effort to ban transgender service members to underscore that LGBT people are all welcome in Canada's military. The parade band of the Ottawa-based Central Band of the Canadian Forces marched in the Pride Parade behind Vance and about 100 other military leaders, including top generals and admirals. Openly gay Sergeant Scott Pohl is a member of the 30-piece military brass band. He said he helped select the repertoire and chose some gay stereotypes of his generation, including I Will Survive, I'm So Excited, and, of course, Dancing Queen. But he added, we threw in a few marches for good measure.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 2nd, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
This is what's occurred overseas. Parents had rights before the law was changed. After the law was changed, their rights to have their children free from compulsory radical LGBTIQ sex education was taken away.
The only young people affected by marriage equality are young gay people who for the first time will have the same dignity as everyone else in our country.
Australia's great hate debate begins later in the program.
Indecision's bugging me. Indecision may molest her. If you don't want me, set me free.
Set me free.
Exactly whom I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow?
Just what will that fate of trans people in the U.S. military be a few months down the road? The White House formalized President Trump's notorious July Twitter attack on trans troops with an August 25th memorandum directing Defense Secretary James Mattis to study the issue and deliver an implementation plan by February 1st next year. This despite earlier Pentagon studies supporting service by transgender enlistees. Meanwhile, activists are counterattacking on the legal front. James Essex of the ACLU and Jillian Weiss of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund discussed the lawsuits with Gay USA's Anne Northrup.
The reason that I'm very optimistic about the prospects both for our lawsuit and the lawsuit that Lambda Legal and OutServe SLDN have brought in Washington State and the lawsuit that the National Center for Lesbian Rights and GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders, GLAAD, have brought in the District of D.C., our cases in Maryland, I think all three cases have a very good shot here for the simple reason that the military did this study over the course of a year to decide, are there any problems? Is there any reason that we can't allow transgender folks to serve openly? And they end up saying there's no reason. And the president is not pointing to some other study, to some other factual basis for saying, oh, they got it wrong. There's no sort of military policy-based reason for this. And so what are you left with? You're left with animus, prejudice, discrimination. This new directive requires the military to discriminate against transgender people.
The courts have historically given enormous deference to the military to make its own decisions about things. And, you know, we may see this action as unconstitutional and discriminatory and having no basis, but if the military goes into court and says, we want this, isn't the court going to say, well, you know, we always defer to the military?
You're right that, in general, the courts have a policy, a practice of deferring to the judgments by the military about military stuff. I think a judge is going to be able to see, I think all three judges in these cases are going to be able to see through whatever sort of post hoc rationalization somebody comes up with to try to explain what I think everyone can see is just like we've got a commander-in-chief who decided to throw away a bunch of people for no reason.
You know, one thing I just want to point out is that when we had Don't Ask, Don't Tell, there were a number of cases brought, including in the Ninth Circuit where, the Lambda Legal case is pending. And, the courts indicated at that time that they thought this was unconstitutional. I mean, they didn't go through with it because the statute was repealed and so on, but I think there is precedent to indicate that this is absolutely unconstitutional for a gay person, a lesbian person, or a transgender person, and a bisexual person. So you gotta let me know.
Should I stay or should I go? The Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund's Jillian Weiss and the ACLU's James Essex spoke this week with Gay USA's Ann Northrup.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Equal life, it's equal life, it's whether you're man and husband or woman and wife. Equal love, it's equal life, it's, we're spelling it out, LGBTI2I.
Australia's High Court is expected to rule this week on a challenge to the validity of the government's non-binding postal plebiscite on marriage equality. But activists on both sides are not waiting around for the answer. This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay reports from Canberra as the gloves come off in the marriage equality campaign down under.
The boundaries of what Australia finds acceptable have certainly come out in the public arena in a big way in debate with the ongoing campaign for same-sex marriage in this country.
School told my son he could wear a dress next year if he felt like it.
When same-sex marriage passes as law overseas, this type of program becomes widespread and compulsory.
The voice of Dr. Pansy Lai, head of the Australian Chinese for Families Association, one of the groups which, along with the Australian Christian Lobby, make up the Coalition for Marriage, which bankrolled and started broadcasting these Vote No ads on Australian TV last week.
Kids in Year 7 are being asked to role play being in a same-sex relationship.
You can say no.
The principal of the school in Melbourne, where the first speaker in the ad sent her kids to school, has told the media that no teachers at the school, Frankston High School, ever spoke about boys wearing dresses to school. Here he is speaking on ABC Radio last week.
We certainly didn't tell him that he would be able to wear a dress to our school. That is this particular parent's claim. That never happened. But I did wonder how it relates to marriage equality.
The head of the Australian Christian Lobby, Lyle Shelton, had this to say on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's 7:30 current affairs show last week.
Well, we want Australians to see the consequences that occur when the law around marriage has changed. This is what's occurred overseas. Parents had rights before the law was changed. After the law was changed, their rights to have their children free from compulsory radical LGBTIQ sex education was taken away. This is not about love. This is about whether people are free to believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, and whether we're allowed to say that out loud.
Dr. Karen Phelps, formerly head of the Australian Medical Association, features in the Yes campaign's ads.
School told my son he could wear a dress next year if he felt like it.
Over the coming weeks, we'll be hearing a lot about whether our family and friends who are gay and lesbian can get married. Sadly, some are trying to mislead us, like this ad does, by saying there'll be a negative impact, including on young people. The only young people affected by marriage equality are young gay people, who for the first time will have the same dignity as everyone else in our country. And they deserve that.
Tiernan Brady, who campaigned successfully in the Irish marriage equality referendum, is now in Australia assisting with the campaign here.
Well, the one thing we know is the No have given up the argument against marriage equality. They know they've lost that. Australia is for marriage equality, so they're not making the case anymore on marriage equality as an issue. So they're going to pretend every day it's about different things. So I think it's going to be a campaign of misleading and misdirection as they talk about everything from safe schools to bathrooms to political correctness. And of course, it's about none of these things. But if you can't win the argument, try and change the argument. And we have to be disciplined and know that that's exactly what they're trying to do here.
The hate debate began a fortnight ago when a white supremacist group allegedly put up posters around Melbourne slandering gay partnerships. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull was asked his thoughts about this on the Em and Harley show on Today FM radio.
I don't know if you've heard, overnight there's been some fairly horrendous posters put around Melbourne with, they say stop the fags, and they have statistics on there that are just made up. 92% of children raised by gay parents are abused, 51% have depression, and 72% are obese. Are
you ridiculous claims.
Yeah, are you willing to denounce the people that made these posters? And I'm a mum, and if my child was homosexual and hearing this rhetoric that is now openly available because of your government, I mean, what do you say to these kids and these parents?
Well, Em, our society, the most successful multicultural society in the world, is built on a foundation of mutual respect. Mm-hmm. So I deplore disrespectful, abusive language, whether it is directed at young gay people or people of other religions or other races. So mutual respect and a respectful debate is what
but
we should have in Australia.
That's out the window, Prime Minister. That's not happening. So what are you going to do to protect these vulnerable kids? Because your respectful debate, with all due respect, is in the toilet.
What I would say to you, Em, is if you have friends who are really distressed by this sort of language, stand up for them. Put your arms around them.
Lauren from the New South Wales Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby had this to say about how the LGBTIQ community should respond to the hate posters and other harmful material.
What is important is that we make sure that we have close family and friends around us that are going to support us, whether or not that be our family or our chosen families. We are building a coalition of people around us to be able to support us through what is, quite frankly, a farcical process. But in the same token, I think it is galvanising so much strength and resilience and hope from a lot of people around us. And it's the personal stories that remind everybody that we are human beings and that we deserve to be loved. I think it's about keeping it respectful. And I think it's also really clear that what they are doing is throwing red herrings and responding to those red herrings and unpacking those red herrings unemotionally and factually. You know, an example of that is that the Marriage Act has been defined in a certain way for decades and decades and decades, which is not true. It's changed 20 times since 1961. And by providing those facts and busting those myths, we can break down those red herrings really quickly.
Tiernan Brady has been travelling around Australia speaking with community groups in various towns and cities.
Well, the response is phenomenal. I mean, the polls are correct. Australian people want marriage equality. They get why this matters. They know that this is about someone who lives on their street. You know, and when we travel around the country, you know, so many people are just so glad to turn up at an event because they want to know what they can do to make it happen. So when people turn up, the great thing is we have a very simple ask. You know, when you tell your story, it's the most powerful thing anybody can do.
I asked him if he was surprised that he got a good response in regional and rural areas.
No, not at all. I think that reflects the Irish experience. You know, the one thing we know about regional and rural areas is they're very strong communities. So they're where there are lesbian and gay people, you know, openly living in those communities, they are defended by those communities. So I think that was really, you know, really strongly reflected in the enthusiasm in those small regional towns.
Alex Greenwich, a sitting member in the New South Wales State Parliament, is also one of the leading figures in the Yes campaign.
It's critical that we ensure as many people get out to vote as possible. So whether that is calling friends and family members, calling other supporters of marriage equality, door knocking, fundraising, these are the key asks which we have of supporters of marriage equality.
What about social media online? How is that working?
It's clear that there is strong support for marriage equality across social media, and that's a wonderful platform for people to be able to share their messages of support and also encourage their friends and followers to do the same.
The 24th of August was the cut-off date for young people to enrol for the first time to vote. Their vote will be very important to the success of the Yes campaign.
The campaign to get people to enrol to vote was the first success of this campaign. The numbers were fantastic, 90,000 new enrolments and 500,000 people updating their details.
Voting in the proposed postal survey will not be compulsory, as is usual with Australian elections and referendums, which could mean that only those who hold a strong opinion one way or the other will be motivated to return their postal ballot papers.
The ballots will be coming out in about 15 days, and most people under all measurements vote within the first 3 days. So that means within roughly 20 days, you know, the vast majority of votes are going to be cast. So this is a short time frame for everybody to get out there and talk to the people that they know, talk to the people who they work with, and explain why this matters and why you have to post your ballot.
The No campaign has been calling for online donations to continue its advertising campaign, saying that it costs $35,000 a night to keep their ads on television. Despite this, not all churches officially back their campaign. Their support base coming mostly from the evangelical and Pentecostal sector. A High Court challenge to the official validity of the postal survey will be heard this week, with a result expected on the 6th of September. If the challenge is successful, the matter goes back to the Parliament, which has, so far, stalemated the issue.
As things stand, I'd be surprised if the government emerges with a victory on this.
Constitutional law expert Professor George Williams of the Law School of the University of New South Wales says that in arranging the postal survey, the government has bypassed Parliament using a special fund reserved for urgent and unforeseen matters. But given that MPs have spoken publicly about the issue for so long, that would be a tough ask to justify in court. Meanwhile, marriage equality rallies held in Australian cities continue to draw record numbers.
Marriage equality! We want no less! How are you going to vote?
Yes, yes, yes!
That sounds amazing.
This is Barry Mackay in Canberra for This Way Out.
When do we want equal love? When do we want it now? I said, when do we want equal love? When do we want it now? Just say love.
This issue of gay marriage, or as I like to call it, marriage. You know, because I had lunch this afternoon, not gay lunch. I parked my car, I didn't gay park it. What do we want? We want equal love.
What do we want? Equal love. When do we want it now? I said, what do we want? Equal love. When do we want it now? Just sweet love, the time is here right now.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Tanya Kane Perry and Wenzel Jones, produced by Steve Pride and Barry McKay, with special thanks to Ann Northrup and Gay USA. The Clash, Michael Ross and Jade Leonard, featuring Dolly Diamond and Luke Gallagher, performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This way out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Lofty Community Radio, Adelaide Hills, South Australia, the Gay Agenda Podcast at kpfk.org, Los Angeles, California, Plains FM, Christchurch, New Zealand, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Classical Hindu philosophical systems have been around for a long time. So has tantric philosophy, which was taken up and adapted by feminist, New Age, and other movements in the West. According to Farah Godridge, Orthodox Hindu thought features a dualism that tends to denigrate the material world while elevating the realm of spirit. So what does the desire to transcend worldly affairs, what does that do to encourage or discourage worldly action and political activism? Farah Godridge has written about that and also about what she sees as the subversive political potential of Tantra, which crucially does not promote a dualism between the material, which Orthodox thought casts as feminine, and the masculine-associated spiritual. Farah Godridge is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Riverside, and her article about the political implications of the tantric tradition and of classical Hindu thought appeared in the journal New Political Science. When Farah joined me in studio, I asked what prompted her to write this article.
What I was trying to do was to really think through the relationship between Hinduism and any kind of political stance. In the U.S., we're used to thinking about the relationship between the predominant religion, which is Christianity, and politics, right? We have a sense for what sort of role Christian beliefs and practices play in mainstream American politics. And I really was trying to think through what the equivalent would be, really, if you were to think through the predominant faith in India, which is Hinduism, and what sorts of different political leanings or commitments or practices it might be allied with.
And what you're doing is you're looking at both Hinduism and the Tantra tradition, tantric thought. And I wonder if we could dive into Orthodox Hinduism to begin. Three of the most prominent or prevalent Orthodox philosophical systems within Hinduism are, and could you say them because I want to make sure they're pronounced correctly?
Sure. They are Sankhya, Yoga, and Advaita Vedanta.
Sankhya. Let's start with Sankhya. I wonder what that strand of thought has to say. And let's start here because it's so critical to everything you write about. The question of matter and spirit. Matter and spirit, what does this first strand, as you present it in your piece, what stance does it take?
So Sankhya is the oldest of what are called the orthodox schools of Hindu philosophy, of classical Hindu philosophy. And Sankhya's sort of view on the nature of the universe, if you will, tends to then be adopted by the later schools, which includes yoga and several other schools, and then in a different guise later, Advaita Vedanta. But Sankhya's metaphysics, if you will, right, its theory of the universe and how the universe is constructed tells us that there's a kind of hierarchy, right? That the material world, right, the body, that which is composed of matter, is inferior to ultimate reality or divinity or spirit, however you want to call it. I mean, we're using English terms to characterize something that is from a different time and place, but that's the best way we can kind of get at. So there's a kind of dualism, right? It's a dualist system of thought in that there are these two categories and the one is clearly inferior to the other. And the other important thing to note is that the one is masculine and the other is feminine. Right.
Which one is which?
So matter is represented by the feminine, which is called prakriti, and spirit or ultimate reality or the divine or the transcendent is represented as masculine, also called purusha. Now, it's worth noting that to this day in India and in sort of commonplace everyday Hindi, the word for man is purusha. So this is it's a very classical, very traditional dichotomy in which the masculine represents transcendence and the feminine represents the material, the bodily, the physical. And of course, right, the material, the bodily, the physical, they're impure, they're polluting, they're false, they're illusory. They keep us from realizing our transcendence, our union with the divine. So the hierarchy is pretty clear.
So the goal of practice within the Sankhya tradition is to transcend the material, is to move toward the, quote, masculine spiritual reality.
Yes, quite right. And it's not just for Sankhya. It's also for the yoga school. And I mention this because the yoga school of thought then ends up becoming tremendously influential for what we today think of as the practice of yoga, right? Which, you know, most people think of as like a bunch of exercises, but actually it's quite heavily rooted in this yogic school of philosophy, which itself, right, is influenced by the Sankhya school. So indeed, for both of these schools and for many other orthodox or classical schools in Hindu thought, the very goal of human life is the transcendent realization, right, of one's purity, of one's divinity, which means moving beyond our materiality, moving beyond our embodiedness, right, our physicality. And by the way, that includes the mental. So in Hindu systems of thought, both mind and body are included in matter, right? Because eventually everything that happens in the mind, just like everything that happens in the body, is transient. It's fleeting, right? It comes and goes. It is not eternal. It does not last. So, and that requires in turn a kind of controlled withdrawal of the senses, right? Going inward, withdrawing, not being attached to the outer physical, worldly, bodily trappings, but rather going inward and detaching from them.
And then the third orthodox philosophical system that you bring up in this piece within Hinduism, Advaita Vedanta, does it retain this dualism?
Yes and no. So it's a later, much, much later school of thought, by about at least 8 centuries or so. And it's sometimes thought to challenge the dualism. In other words, Advaita Vedanta is often characterized as the foremost non-dual school in Hindu philosophy. And it's non-dual in the following sense. Advaita Vedanta tells us that ultimate reality is no different from the individual self, that there's no actual division or separation between us, the physical, and us, the transcendent. They are one and the same. So you are divine. You are that. The self is the ultimate. But despite that, despite what seems like a non-dualism, there is actually a legacy of dualism that kind of creeps into Advaita Vedanta, because Advaita Vedanta continues to tell us that the material is false, it's illusory, it's polluting, it's suspect. And by the way, in a lot of the myths and stories in this tradition, this is very often symbolized or represented by a woman. So Adi Shankara, who was the founding sort of scholar, philosopher, monk of that tradition, is often described as being lured away by a woman or being sort of attracted by a woman. And that interaction often sort of symbolizes, right, the push and pull. We are both material and transcendent, but in the end, really, we've got to get beyond our material nature. So I would characterize it as non-dual in some sense, but also kind of retaining a legacy of its predecessors.
What have commentators, or maybe the majority of commentators, said about the degree to which this focus on transcendence affects attitudes towards social and political engagement in the real material world and improving the material world?
Well, traditionally, these classical schools, Orthodox Hinduism, is thought to be actually quite opposed to involvement in worldly matters, right? Because if you think about it, if the goal of an individual life is to go within, to transcend, to liberate oneself, right, from the trappings of worldly life, then why care about anything that's happening in the world? And indeed, many leading voices within the tradition and also sort of later commentators have have said precisely this, which is that, you know, there's this famous dichotomy in Hinduism between the householder and the renunciate.
The renunciate being the monk, the ascetic?
Right. Mm-hmm. The renunciate being the monk, the ascetic, and the householder being the person who, you know, is involved in running a home and having children and a family and caring about the social world. And it's thought traditionally that the renunciate or the ascetic is the kind of revered figure in Hinduism. That's the person that one is supposed to become ultimately. And so in Hinduism, there's often a theory of four stages of life. There's the stage of the student, the stage of the householder, the stage of, you know, the person who's kind of giving up worldly life, and then finally the renunciate. So, you know, it's thought to be kind of goal-oriented, right? That the final stage is the one toward which you end. But that, what does that mean? If one is an ascetic, if one is a renunciate, if one is focused entirely on transcending the world, then family, society, politics, even suffering, justice, injustice, ethics, how does any of that matter? And so there's a suggestion that classically Hinduism is thought to be amoral, antisocial, anti-women, anti-sexuality, anti-family, and so on and so forth. And that's just one interpretation, but it's certainly an interpretation that I think has some currency.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Farah Godridge joins us. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside. And we are talking about an article she wrote about the political potential, the progressive political potential of Hindu philosophy, and especially the tantric tradition that appeared in the journal New Political Science. So I think you've already begun to answer my question about kind of what this dualism, the dualism between the material, which is cast as the feminine, and the spiritual, which is cast as the masculine, what that dualism has done to gender hierarchies and gender relations in India over the years and centuries. Could you elaborate on that and also talk about caste hierarchies and the extent to which this dualism, as emphasized by the Orthodox Hindu tradition and philosophy, how that dualism might have fed caste hierarchies as well?
Sure. Well, if you think about it, in traditional societies, it's the feminine that is closer to nature, to the sphere of the domestic, to the body, through reproduction, and through continuing sort of biological ties. And so really this association of the feminine with the material has persisted. And that hierarchy where, you know, women are the ones who sort of take care of the domestic and the material and the sort of natural spheres, whereas men are the ones who are scholars and priests and sort of transcendent aspirers, that hierarchy has persisted, right? And that's not unique, by the way, to Hinduism or to India. And then the other social group, which is close to nature, to the body, to caring for the body and to the products of the body, are lower castes. So, you know, I'm not sure how much your listeners know about caste in India. It's an incredibly fraught topic. But one can say, and I think most people would agree, that caste persists as a way of organizing social life in many parts of India, not all of India, and certainly I think less so in urban parts of India today, but in much of India, caste persists. And the idea of caste simply is that certain people are born into certain social groups, and that birth into a certain social group then demands certain social stratification and certain occupations. The caste hierarchy basically follows this hierarchy, the matter-spirit hierarchy that we've seen in the Orthodox traditions. Just as the feminine is closer to nature and to the body and to working with one's hands and doing labor and so forth, so too are lower castes, right? If one is born into lower castes, those are the castes which clean up after people. Those are the castes which deal with the products of our bodily lives. Whereas higher castes, particularly, you know, the Brahmin or the priestly class, those are the castes in which people are pursuing thought and transcendence.
Okay, obviously there's much more to be said about the Orthodox Hindu tradition, its many strands, but I want to move at this point to Tantra. You call this a dissenting school that emerged in the early medieval era. First, is Tantra philosophy a monolith? Is it a single, consistent set of principles and ideas?
Absolutely not. Like everything else in the sort of rich tradition of Hinduism, Tantra is represented by a variety of texts and ideas and practices and traditions. In fact, the very word Tantra is a retrospective classification. It's really only probably a century or so ago that scholars decided to apply a single term to what was until then a kind of loosely affiliated set of texts and practices. And like so many other terms in the Sanskrit lexicon, the term Tantra has been used in so many different ways to mean so many different things. And, you know, the other famous Sanskrit term that has that baggage, of course, is the word yoga, which can mean so many things to so many people. But so no, Tantra is not a monolith. But I would say that there are probably certain core concepts, ideas, and practices that we can loosely say characterize these texts and ideas.
And if we kind of look at the common strands within Tantra, where do these strands, or where does the core of Tantra stand on this issue of denigrating, for example, in the Orthodox Hindu strands you spoke of, denigrating the feminine material world and elevating the spiritual world, which, you know, is characterized, which is cast as masculine?
Well, Tantra is radically non-dualist. So in contrast to, you know, when we talked about Advaita Vedanta, we said that it was non-dual in some sense, but that there was a kind of dualism that had crept in. Tantra, in contrast to its predecessors, asserts that the physical world and the transcendent or the ultimate reality are, not only are they not separate from each other, they are all made of a single intelligent energy. And that everything one experiences in the physical world, everything one experiences in the material world, is itself a manifestation of the divine. Now, to some extent, Advaita Vedanta held that too, but what distinguishes Tantra from its predecessors is that Tantra holds that the body is sacred. The body is itself a kind of receptacle of divinity. So whereas its predecessor traditions were constantly trying to deny or suppress or transcend or ignore the body in any number of ways, for the tantric practitioner, the body is the vehicle through which you attain liberation. You don't deny it. You don't suppress it. You don't try to make the urges go away. So desire, right, is a very key component of all of this. For the predecessor classical dualist schools of thought, desire is a real problem, because desire is the very thing that symbolizes our gross materiality, right, our sort of craven humanness, if you will. And that's the problem that everyone's trying to get past. But for the tantric practitioners, our desire is itself divine. Yes, it makes us human, but it's also the thing that can lead us toward divinity. So let's harness it, the tantric texts tell us. Let's harness its power, and let's actually use embodied experiences like food, music, art, and of course, most famously, sex, right? Let's use these embodied experiences as doorways, if you will, to realizing our ultimate union with divinity.
Farah Godridge is her name. She teaches political science at UC Riverside. She's author of Cosmopolitan Political Thought, Method, Practice, and Discipline. And we are talking about an article she wrote. It's entitled Orthodoxy and Dissent in Hinduism's Meditative Traditions, A Critical Tantric Politics with a question mark. It appeared in the journal New Political Science. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Where do tantric texts locate the feminine and the masculine?
For tantric texts and practices and practitioners, unlike for its predecessors, for whom, and this will be familiar actually to Western beliefs and religions, you know, in Western and also in classical Hindu beliefs, the feminine is the receptive, passive force, whereas the masculine is dynamic and active and creative. Tantra inverts that. In tantric metaphysics, in the tantric view of the universe, the feminine principle is the causal principle behind everything in the universe. In other words, the feminine makes everything happen. It's the dynamic life force behind everything that's happening. It is the creative force of the universe. The masculine principle in Tantra is the force of stillness and awareness and stability. So very often in the tantric traditions, there are different forms of meditation, but the forms of meditation in which one learns to quiet the mind and sort of be the awareness behind all of the chaos of the mind, that is often said to approximate masculine stillness. Whereas the forms of meditation in which one contemplates the sort of dynamism and movement of the universe, those are said to represent the feminine. And crucially, in the tantric set of texts and beliefs and practices, there's no hierarchy. It's the union between these two that symbolizes that ultimate non-dual presence, which is within everything and everyone.
Well, talk about the goddess figure, and I think it's goddess figures, right, in tantric thought, in tantra. So you have this feminine energy, this dynamic energy. It's personified, as you write, in the goddess Shakti. What forms does Shakti take?
Shakti takes a variety of different forms. She can take a kind of militant, destructive, terrifying form as one of the warrior goddesses. The most well-known ones are Durga and her alter ego Kali. These goddesses are also quite unapologetically sexual. Or she can take a kind of sweeter, more wifely, domestic form like Lakshmi or Parvati. So she can take a variety of different forms, but in all of these forms, she is the feminine as the creative power.
So if in Tantra there is no kind of dualism between the material and the spiritual, what stance would Tantra take toward the parts of the material world, the aspects of material existence that one might find especially disturbing or disgusting, you know, talking about perhaps in the parlance of Orthodox Hindu tradition, some of the most polluting aspects of the material life, of material existence?
Yeah, this is a great question. So it depends a little bit on whether one is talking about left-handed or right-handed tantra. There are sort of two paths, I think, broadly speaking, within tantric practice. The right-handed path is considered the more conventional, the more in keeping with sort of traditional mores, if you will. But the left-handed path, I think, is really the one that is more antinomian, kind of anti-establishmentarian, unconventional, transgressive, really. And it's in that path that I think we see most clearly tantra's stance toward the body. And I think in that path, we find that it's not simply that one embraces the body and that one sort of harnesses the energy of the body. It goes even further. It's that one must learn to experience divinity within everything. And that includes some of the most horrifying and polluting aspects of reality. for instance, in Orthodox Hinduism, you know, there are rituals of purity and pollution. And very often these rituals involve abstaining from things like meat and alcohol and sexual intercourse and so forth that are considered, you know, polluting because of their sort of association with base bodily, you know, desires. Whereas Tantra says, let us experience the profane. Let us truly experience the profane, the shocking, the polluting in order to see that the divine is within everything and then to transcend. So very often one hears ancient stories of tantric practitioners practicing in cremation grounds and graveyards or drinking out of skulls. I don't know how true these are, but I think they're more symbolic. Their importance is symbolic. They symbolize the tantric practitioner's belief that through violating these conventional norms, through violating that distinction between the pure and the impure, the sacred and the profane, that's how you experience true power, true transcendence.
Farah Godridge is her name. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Riverside. We are talking about an article I found in the journal New Political Science that she wrote about the political potential of the tantric tradition and its ideas and the Hindu tradition. And we'll speak more with Farah, especially about the political implications of what she's been telling us about these philosophies. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song, a political scientist named Farah Godridge, who is based at UC Riverside, joins me in studio. And she is the author of a book called Cosmopolitan Political Thought. Her areas of research and teaching include Indian political thought, Gandhi's political thought, cosmopolitanism, globalization, comparative political theory, and environmental political thought. And we are talking about an article she wrote about Hinduism and Tantra and the political potential that might be found within either of those traditions. And we're talking about a variety of strands, of course, of different ways of thinking and different schools of thought within these traditions, Hinduism and Tantra. So the acceptance and in some sense the embrace of the material world by Tantra, by tantric texts, that suggests to me that maybe, okay, involvement in worldly affairs might not be so taboo and might not be so negative in the eyes or in the view of this tradition as it was with some of the orthodox Hindu strands you were talking about, where the material world is considered really almost beneath our concern. We should focus on transcendence. We should focus on moving toward the spiritual. So is that one political implication one might take, that involvement in the material world, in what's happening in our everyday existence, might be more the Tantra practitioners or people who are inspired by tantric ideas might be more ready to be involved in these kinds of things?
I think it can go one of two ways. On the one hand, if one is embracing everything as an expression of the divine, as a manifestation of Shakti or divine energy, it's possible that one could arrive at a kind of apolitical indifference to suffering or injustice. I mean, after all, it's all Shakti. And I've heard practitioners say something to that effect. Oh, it's all Shakti. It's all the work of the Shakti. Shakti will do as she must. And that that can lead to a kind of apathy. That can lead to a kind of indifference. Or who am I to get in the way of what Shakti is doing? My goal is to embrace it, to embrace the horror as well as the divinity. But I think it's a little dangerous because I think that can also lead to a kind of caricature of Tantra. And this is actually something that has been the case, I think, in sort of colonial orientalist caricatures of Tantra. And this is partly why Tantra, I think, has been driven underground in India, which is that during the colonial period, it was seen as this kind of, degenerate, amoral, transgressive way of life and really vilified as such. So I think it's dangerous to think that that's the only way tantric beliefs can lead. I think it's also possible that one celebrates the material world as a manifestation of Shakti's life-giving power, and therefore one is inspired to protect it and make it free of suffering. Because if Shakti has given us this incredible universe, then perhaps it's our duty to make it as beautiful as we can, to make it as divine as we can. So I think it can go both ways. I think it contains a kind of potential for extreme attention to the suffering of others, but also a potential for indifference. And I think it would depend on the practitioner.
And what about on the issue of gender and on the status of women and on how women are viewed? The, in a sense, celebration of the feminine by Tantra, would that necessarily suggest to you that women would be treated better, would be treated in a more humane way, viewed in a more humane way?
I think the short answer is yes, but it's not without complication. I think it's true that if one is being strictly tantric about one's approach to gender, then yes, the feminine is worshipped as symbolic of divinity. Definitely, there is not the kind of hierarchy that one sees in Orthodox Hinduism. The feminine is not only not construed as impure, but is actually sort of seen as the force that makes everything happen. And accordingly, one would imagine that women would hold a kind of a place that's free of, you know, hierarchy and oppression and so forth. But I think that that is actually complicated by the fact that there's actually a kind of gender essentialism in tantric belief as well, you know, because putting women on a pedestal and worshipping them for their biological capabilities, that's a really old story in some ways. It's an old story of how patriarchy continues to persist, right? So I think it's a little tricky. I think it's tricky and complex, and I don't think that one can simply say that a tantric set of commitments automatically leads to a healthy relationship between the genders. But I certainly think that tantric commitments invert and resist the hierarchies that classical Hinduism gave us. And they certainly free their practitioners from all the anxiety around the body that Hinduism is so weighted down by.
And that freedom from anxiety and freedom from, in some sense, repressiveness was very popular with the West, with people in the West who took up tantric ideas or what they thought were tantric ideas. And I'm speaking here about the latter part of the 20th century with the liberation movements, the New Age crowd, feminist movements. What do you make of that adoption of or appropriation of tantric philosophy in the West?
Well, I think it's trivializing and distorting. That's what I make of it. I mean, I'm sure others may have different perspectives on it, but, you know, it's what some scholars have called pop tantra, right? It's the sort of the New Age and the kind of countercultural liberation movements of the late 20th century saw tantra's embrace of the body as something to undergird their own pursuit, right, of sex positivity and self-help and all of the other stuff that came with the New Age, none of which, by the way, I have any objection to. It's simply that, you know, a tradition like Tantra, which is so rich, was taken and I think kind of reduced to one element, which was its sexual practice. And to this day, if you say Tantra or Tantric to any Westerner, there's literally one thing that they think of, and that's sex. They'll say, oh yeah, I know about Tantric sex, right? But Tantra is actually about much, much more than that. But somehow in its appropriation, in its employment in the New Age movement, it's gotten kind of reduced. It's gotten reduced to a kind of cult of ecstasy. And that, I think, is unfortunate.
I'm joined by Farah Godridge, and her last name is spelled G-O-D-R-E-J. Her first name is F-A-R-A-H, and she is a political scientist at UC Riverside. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. There's so much more to ask you about, but I'm interested in whether, as you think about the political potential of specifically Tantra, whether you are more focused on its possible application in India with its caste and gender hierarchies and other hierarchies, or the U.S. with its own inequalities and hierarchies.
I have focused more on Tantra's emancipatory potential in India. I think the life of Tantra in the West has gone in a very different direction, as we just spoke about. It's actually much more interesting to me, having myself grown up in India as a woman and having experienced what gender dynamics in India are like, to think a little bit about what Tantra's emancipatory potential might be, with, of course, all the cautions that I already mentioned. The really interesting thing about Tantra in India is that I never heard about it growing up in India. It is only much later, having come to the West and become an academic and started reading and studying the South Asian tradition, that I began to learn about it. If one hears of Tantra in India, it is in a very, very marginal way. Oh, Tantra is what those weird voodoo black magic people do. That's the stereotype of Tantra in India. And I think the reason for that is that Tantra was largely driven underground. And it was driven underground. I mean, you can imagine, right? It's this heterodox dissenting tradition that is basically taking all the caste and gender hierarchies of the predominant tradition and trying to subvert them. And I think that the British colonial regime was an important story in all of this, because first of all, Hinduism as a whole had to be painted in a certain way by the British in order to justify why it is that we need to civilize these people, the civilizing mission, right? So already Hinduism was treated in a certain way by sort of the Orientalist discourse of the colonial powers. On top of that, within Hinduism was this other dissenting strand, right, where women are being worshipped and the goddesses are these crazy sexual figures. I mean, you can just imagine what the British made of that. And so Tantra was sort of resoundingly vilified, not just by the British, but then by Indian elites who had kind of internalized British Orientalist logic and who wanted to kind of sanitize and civilize Hinduism so that it could be accorded a degree of respectability. Right, so it was really respectability politics, if you will, that drove Tantra, I think, underground, both by Indian elites and from sort of critiques by the British. And the way that that happened, I think, is that Tantra was domesticated. And what I mean by domesticated is simply that these fierce goddesses, with all of their unapologetic sexuality and their warrior-like characters, started to be painted as sweet and docile and loving and deferential. So I think it's worth thinking about what it would mean for India and predominant Hindu culture within India, because of course the two things are very different. Hinduism is only one among many faiths in India. What it would mean for the predominant faith of India to recover or rediscover this other dissenting strand. I think there's a tremendous potential there, and I think it's probably tremendously threatening as well. But it's there.
And I could see it being threatening, especially to the right wing in India, the Hindu right wing. What have they done in terms of appealing to classical Hindu ideas? And how difficult would it be for subversion of the kind that you're suggesting to happen in that atmosphere of the ascendance of the right wing in India?
It's very difficult in India to speak about the convergence of Hinduism with politics without having that conversation completely and utterly co-opted by the right wing, unfortunately. And this is because all revivals of classical Hindu thought within contemporary thinking, and especially within politics, have occurred, I think, solely through the lens and the voice of the nationalist Hindu right wing. So that, in the words of one scholar, I'm paraphrasing now, it's actually almost impossible to think of any Hindu religious text or practice intervening in politics without it having a kind of right-wing Hindu dimension. And that is very, very unfortunate. So it's difficult to talk about all this without making some sweeping generalizations, which I'm always a little wary of, but being mindful that we are having a limited conversation, I would say then that in contemporary India, the Hindu right-wing platform has really relied upon a kind of high-caste resentment regarding the socioeconomic mobility of lower castes, and also the invocation of a kind of retrograde conception of gender and sexuality in which the woman is cast as pure, unpolluted, and expressions of sexuality are particularly frowned upon as foreign to Hindu culture. And given everything we've said, that's actually just inaccurate. But it is the party line. It is the party line discourse. And by the way, it's not just the Hindu right wing, which has leaned on the kind of orthodox hierarchies and sort of wants to make sexuality disappear altogether. I would say that Gandhi, who was otherwise very politically progressive, certainly in his insistence on breaking down caste hierarchies, in his insistence on Hindu-Muslim unity, Gandhi himself was highly masculinist and highly dualist in his views on sexuality. And I think Gandhi would be mortified by the version of Tantra that I'm giving you. So a kind of puritanical morality in which both men and women, but particularly women, are construed as asexual, as devoid of sexual desire, and as therefore pure and kind of standing in for the Hindu nation, if you will. This is all very commonplace in sort of contemporary Hindu political discourse. And I think that Tantra, given everything we've said, can intervene greatly in that.
Gandhi comes off as a complicated figure in your article, and I really appreciate that. We're talking about an article by my guest Farah Godridge that appeared in the journal New Political Science last June, for those of you who want to look up the article. But of course, you know, we do have to say, and you did say, that he had a number of progressive views that, you write, he took from, for example, classic Hindu texts like the Bhagavad Gita. He found a way to, for example, synthesize the realms of renunciation and activism. So it wasn't just about renouncing all worldly activity. He obviously was in favor of social action, political action. Given that, do you see any, or I should say, what do you see as the political potential of classical Hindu philosophy? You've talked about the political implications of taking a tantric stance, but what about somehow using orthodox Hindu ideas to shake things up in India?
Well, the orthodox tradition is hardly speaks with one voice. there is the strand of the Orthodox or the classical traditions that values renunciation and perhaps deprioritizes engagement with the socio-political world. But there is also another strand, actually multiple strands, of that tradition which reflect at length on matters of ethics, economic policy, jurisprudence, statecraft, and so on, which are all highly worldly matters pertaining to society and politics and so forth. And this, you know, this body of literature is quite large and quite complex. There's the theory of the purusharthas, which many of my colleagues have actually written about, in which you have four purposes or goals to life. This is different from the four stages that I discussed earlier. These are four goals or four purposes, and they are kama, which is desire, artha, which is wealth or power, dharma, which is ethics, and moksha, which is liberation. And the fact that kama and artha are two of the four most important goals, in other words, desire or pleasure, and wealth or power or prosperity, depending on how you translate it. The fact that those two are so important suggests that the Hindu tradition is not entirely devoid of emphasis on worldly questions. One of the most important demonstrations of this is within the Bhagavad Gita, we have an emphasis on a concept called karma yoga. And this is actually the concept that I think inspired Gandhi, this idea that we do have to give up our desires. We do have to focus on renouncing desire. But in so doing, we're renouncing our attachments and we are actually trying to undertake disciplined action according to what the welfare of all demands. So this concept of disciplined worldly action for the welfare of all, while renouncing one's own desire, that's how I translate karma yoga, comes to us from the Bhagavad Gita, which is the canonical text of classical Hinduism.
And so you are implying in some sense that there is an emancipatory political potential within Orthodox classical Hinduism?
I think this is deeply dependent on interpretation. I think that if one interprets disciplined worldly action for the welfare of all to include people of all genders, then yes. But I think if one remains attached to a particular hierarchical conception of groups like caste and gender by birth, then I think that emancipatory potential starts to look less powerful.
And as we wrap up, Farah, I mean, it's clear from this article that you feel like the subversive political potential of Tantra is greater than of classical Hindu philosophy. Which aspect of Tantra and its transgressive nature do you think would best help to subvert orthodoxies that currently dominate Indian society and culture?
I think the potential of Tantra is greatest to intervene in sort of the existing hierarchies of gender and caste in India. And I say this with some caution because I've already talked about how, you know, there's some problems in Tantra's approach to gender. And by the way, its approach to gender is also extremely heteronormative. So I don't see this as a kind of catch-all solution uncritically. But I do think that in a context, in a deeply patriarchal, hierarchical context where sexual desire has been read as the singular property of the male, where the female has been repeatedly and consistently prevented from having any permissible, expressible sexual desire, and has been morally policed and punished repeatedly. I mean, we can cite Supreme Court rulings and all sorts of legal and political mechanisms to shut down sexuality in general, but particularly female sexuality, and to police the bodies of women. In that context, I think introducing Tantra's reverence for feminine sexuality as a powerful concept worthy of worship is deeply, deeply dissident and subversive. I don't think it's easy, but I fantasize about a way to see a kind of religious revival, if you will, a kind of neo-tantric revival, an indigenous revival. And by indigenous, I mean it really has to come from within India by indigenous practitioners, indigenous to India, I should say. That's kind of a loaded term. But I fantasize about Indian feminists and Indian queer activists and other marginalized peoples, low caste or formerly untouchable Dalit people in India, claiming and reclaiming Tantra as their own to resist the kind of patriarchal essentialism that casts female sexuality as a moral aberration. And so I can imagine a kind of revival of tantric feminism in contemporary India. This may be my own fantasy, but it's a transgressive, subversive, and I hope a hopeful one.
Farah Godridge is an associate professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside. She's author, again, of Cosmopolitan Political Thought, Method, Practice, and Discipline. And we've been talking about an article she wrote. It's entitled Orthodoxy and Dissent in Hinduism's Meditative Traditions, A Critical Tantric Politics, with a question mark. It appeared in the journal New Political Science last June. Farah, delightful meeting you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, C.S. It's been a pleasure.
And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. And you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.